Spokesperson, call the meeting to order. The first announcement that I have is on the email agenda that went out, the notice, the appropriate notice that went out. There are three bills that unfortunately are not listed on the agenda outside. This is, as you might imagine, a very fluid process towards deadline time. So there are three additional bills that have been appropriately noticed and that are the on the agenda for today. They are as follows. 3790, 3823, and 3864. They deal with auto insurers, collision repair shops, and electronic recording. And we're going to move around a little bit. We always try to take non-member items before we do member bills. The first item that we're going to do is Representative Cole's bill. It is House File 3476, Senate File 2908. The chair will move that that file be recommended to pass and sent to the House floor. My understanding, Representative Coles, there is a minor amendment to the A2 amendment. We do not, you and I spoke earlier, we do not have this one in our packet, but you did have an opportunity to have it drafted to the bill. It, I will note it, I will move it, and then if you would be kind enough to explain it. on line 1.1, it would change the House file to Senate File 2908, the first engrossment. On line 1.2 of your amendment, it says page 2, line 21, it would delete the words provides and the tenant receives, end quote, and would insert, quote, mails, comma, by first class mail to the tenant at the property address. That will put it in the shape that the author desires to move it forward. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, seeing none. Representative Cole, be real.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 2908 is a product of Representative Mullery's working group over the summer. This provides certain notice to tenants when their landlord is being foreclosed upon. Mr. Chairman, the bill is non-controversial. All of the interested stakeholders, the lenders, the banks, the multi-housing folks, the people from legal aid are all supportive of the bill. It passed the Senate already unanimously last week. It was heard in public safety last week, passed out without any concern or objection. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to explain some of the intricacies of the bill, but given your lengthy agenda, I'd stand for questions. It might be more.
Thank you, Representative Coles. We actually scheduled it for the first hour, so we're just going to sit in. No. Thank you, Representative Coles. Is there anyone that desires to testify with respect to this House file? Seeing none, are there questions or concerns from members of the committee? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 34
Senate File.
I'm going to do both. House File 3476, now known as Senate File 2908, be recommended to pass and refer to the House floor as amended. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Coles. Next up is House File 3566, Representative Nelson's bill. The chair will move. That House File 3566 be recommended and passed and referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations. Representative Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for hearing 3566. This is the Work Comp Advisory Council recommended bill. In your packet, you'll see a letter that's from Commissioner Swigum, David Olson from the Minnesota Chamber, and from Ray Waldron from the Minnesota AFL-CIO. They've all signed off on this bill, and they agree that the provisions that are in there. The important things, the key things that this bill does is, number one, it increases the maximum weekly compensation rate for injured workers from $750 a week to $850 a week. That hasn't gone up since 1995. It also extends the time frame that injured workers can have to request retraining. It does this, it pays for this by squeezing savings out of the current system by streamlining paperwork and moving to a data-driven system instead of the current forms-driven system, which will save money and make stuff go faster. And updating, it does it also by updating the relative, the worker compensation relative value schedule, fee schedule, and by allowing the department the ability to update this by referencing the Medicare relative value fee schedule. It also allows the Department of Labor and Industry to schedule, or excuse me, to use sampling methods to check and audit files and to make sure benefits are paid properly instead of checking every single bill. One thing I need to correct that I misspoke on when I presented this in labor, the labor committee, was that in section 8 of the bill, the part there is another way we're getting savings out of the system. It provides that injured workers who get treated out of state get paid at the workers' comp rate that's in that state instead of the currently they're paid on the usual and customary fee, which is usually higher. So this is actually a savings to the system, and I actually had that reversed when I spoke about it in the previous committee. The last thing that this bill does is there was an amendment that was put on that was agreed to by all sides, was that it moves a section of law from 176.81 subdivision 2B to section 79A.04 subdivision 3A, and this is regarding the self-insured groups and the acceptable forms of security that they need to have to put, and it puts this section in another section of law that deals with that same thing. These changes were agreed to by the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, the Chamber of Commerce, and Organized Labor, and I hope you support the bill.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Just one technical question. It's my understanding that the bill was amended in division on Friday. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is the version that we have before us the...
My understanding you should have the amended version. I believe that's the one that's there. It should be... I have it here in my packet. Section 17 of the bill. It says revisers instructions, the reviser statute, so recode Minnesota statutes. Is that the version that you have? The page 23.5.
Let me check. I was wondering where the change was. I don't believe that has been. You're talking on line 23.5.
Yes.
All we have, Representative Nelson, is it indicates repealer on the version that we have before us. So it's
this is the version I just got printed to me off the revisor's office.
Okay.
I can give this to you for your records. Or
why don't you give it to Julia if you would? She's our special assistant. And I'd like to take the testimony on the bill. We'll see if we can dress it up in the fashion that it needs to be before us before you take off on us. Are there folks that desire to testify with respect to House File 3566? Okay, please come on down. And if you just identify who you are and then proceed with your testimony. Right there in the... Right at the table. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
I'm Catherine Berg. I'm from Woodbury, Minnesota, and I'm testifying as a citizen and as a practitioner of alternative therapies. I'm a classical homeopath. I've had at least 10 years of education in that particular field. And what you may not recognize from this bill is that there is a portion of it which says that complementary alternative health care providers, any service, article, or supply provided by an unlicensed complementary alternative health care practitioner, as defined in Section 146A.01 Subdivision 6, is not compensable under this chapter. And I would like to just state a number of points against that particular line. First of all, many Minnesotans access these practitioners because they find them to be safe and effective. They spend a lot of money out of their own pockets, and they wouldn't do that if that weren't the case. And these are based on studies. This is studies show that the majority of Minnesotans are using some holistic care. Minnesota should do a study on cost-effectiveness of complementary alternative health care before they put this into a bill that prevents this from happening. It isn't just saying that they have to do this, is preventing it from happening. You know, very few drug companies are going to spring for this sort of study, and since it affects the bottom line of the citizens in the state of Minnesota, there should be a study done on that. I heard it said that perhaps if I practiced with a licensed practitioner, then that would be okay, and then my work could be compensated by this act. But the problem is, I know of one MD who would be qualified to supervise me in the Twin Cities area. There's another MD who practices homeopathy, but she hasn't been practicing as long as I, and she hasn't got as much education. And I know of one chiropractor who would be qualified to do that. There are many good acupuncturists, but massage therapists, Rolfers, who have helped a lot of people that I know, and we've tried to get them here to testify, but it was a little bit short notice. who really would like to still have the choice to use alternative therapies. They work quickly, they work rapidly, and I treat injuries all the time with my homeopathic practice. And that's all I have to say about it. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Berg. Any questions for Ms. Berg? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Mr. Cashman?
Yes.
Please come on up and state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
My name is Leo Cashman. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
I'm one of the founders and board members of the Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. And our organization has the same concerns as the previous speaker regarding the language that would prohibit coverage under workers' comp for services provided by practitioners practicing under 146A. And our organization really spearheaded the awareness of the problem starting about 10 years ago, that there are barriers to the practice of complementary and alternative health care in Minnesota. Legislators heard those concerns. Legislators acted upon that, and in year 2000, there was a near unanimous passage of 146A in both houses. It was signed into law by Governor Ventura. It was a really wonderful step forward for health freedom, and removed some important legal barriers. It recognized that there are some things that are being done by practitioners that are really too safe to license, too safe to need licensure, too safe to need registration. Massage therapy is a good example, homeopathy, and there are a number of other examples. And so what we would suggest to you respectfully is that modalities should not be penalized because they're too safe to be licensed. They can be effective, even though they're so safe that the legislature does not deem it necessary to license them. And so that's why we're rather taken aback that there is this language here to prohibit coverage under workers' comp of practitioners doing such safe, natural therapies. And so is it the policy of the state of Minnesota that modalities, therapies have to be dangerous to be effective, that they have to be invasive, that they have to, require licensure to be of assistance? We have become aware that there's a lot of cost effectiveness, there's a lot of naturalness in these non-invasive, non-drug, non-surgical approaches. They can be very beneficial, and so we hope that this can be deleted out of the bill, and we would love to see that happen today. I've heard that, you know, this is a done deal, you can't change the language. Well, I think that committees can change the language. Committees can delete this objectionable language. It is anti-health freedom. And when we pass language that's anti-health freedom, that diminishes the freedom of everybody in this room and everybody in the state of Minnesota. And we think that would be something the legislature would not want to do. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cashman. Ms. Decker, come guess. Is there a Ms. Decker or someone else like to be heard on this? Okay. Representative Nelson?
I'd like to have Patricia Todd from Department of Labor and Industry come and speak to this portion of the bill.
Okay. Ms. Todd, please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready. We're kind of, as you can imagine or see, we've got a pretty full room, so if you can be brief, that'd be much appreciated.
No problem. I'm Patricia Todd. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Workers' Compensation at the Department of Labor and Industry. As Representative Nelson indicated, we had a great deal of meetings in regard to what was going to be brought forth in regard to the Work Comp Advisory Council bill, as well as the fact that the employer group, as well as the employee group, signed off on the changes that were recommended in regard to everything. In regard to the specific reference in regard to alternative health care, it is allowed, provided that it's under the direction of a licensed health care provider. And so that's not like it's being prohibited in all cases. It just requires that someone who is licensed is involved in and aware of that specific care.
Thank you very much. Good job. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If, just so that I understand, if because I've taken advantage of workers' comp, I've hurt myself in the job. I go to the doctor, and the doctor says, I want you to go try acupuncture. That's enough to be under licensed care?
Okay, Representative, the way that it's written is that as long as that acupuncturist is under the direction of or in part of that same company as that acupuncturist, then it's okay. So as long as they're in the same organization. But I do believe that acupuncturists themselves are actually licensed, so it doesn't relate to those individuals themselves.
Representative Mahoney. Anybody else in the audience that'd like to be heard on this? Okay. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and go ahead. And
I'm sorry if any of my testimony is repetitive.
Please state your name for the record.
I'm Deirdre Decker.
Thank you.
I'm a citizen who's been glad recipient of various alternative and complementary health care modalities, and anything that chips away at our freedom to choose these modalities, which are both effective and cost effective in most cases, and it's up to the consumer to choose, to do our due diligence and determine whether this is a practice or a, or a practitioner that I'd like to work with. And so I feel really much more confident and covered by the current statute that it gives me that freedom of choice. And anything that chips away from that, I'm really very interested in, speaking up to. So I would very much like to recommend that the committee strike the language about complementary alternative items not being compensated.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Decker? Any questions up here? Representative Simpson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, or if you want to have somebody from the agency, I've got a few questions I'd like to know. How many people does this affect annually? This increasing disability from 750 to 850. On an annual basis, how many people are we talking?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as to the amount of individuals that it affects at the 750 to 850, right now the state average weekly wage is at 808. So that would mean 50% of the citizens are making more than $808. However, the comp rate, the maximum comp rate, is two-thirds of the maximum rate. So it affects citizens that are making more than $1,150 per week.
Representative Simpson?
Okay, and to that point, on an annual basis, how many cases are we talking? Are we talking 200 or 2,000 or?
I can't tell you for sure the exact number, but it's definitely more than 2,000. On average, we have approximately 30,000 workers' compensation claims per year, so would it be probably affecting somewhere between 5 and 10, maybe? But I could do some additional evaluation if that's what you would like.
Representative Simpson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so do you have any idea what the total cost of this increase is going to be to the business community?
Chair, Representative, the way that the bill is written at this point, as the Representative Nelson indicated, there are cost savings in the bill that will cover the majority of the cost increases associated with the changes specifically in the bill. At this point, I believe we estimated that the 750 to 850 is a 0.4% system cost, increase, but it's offset by other portions of the bill, which will decrease other areas of the system.
Thank you, Ms. Scott. Representative Sims,
just one more follow-up, and I think you just indicated that it should take care of most of the costs. If there are additional costs in this, can you tell me how those costs will be borne or where they'll be passed on to?
Ms. Scott?
I guess the simple answer would be in the workers' comp rate, the insurance rates that are charged to employers.
Okay. Representative Simpson, anything further?
No, thank you, and that's what I was trying to get at. But this will cost the business community, so I just want everybody to be made aware of that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. That's why we worked hard over the summer to get on the other side of it, to try and get savings out of the system, and working with the hospitals and working with the department to try and streamline so that get some efficiencies out of the system to lower those costs so that those would be offset so that the bill would be revenue neutral.
Thank you. Okay. Other questions or concerns from members of the committee? Representative Nelson, with respect to the point that the testifiers made, what was the discussion with regard to why they were not, and maybe it's just been a general discussion relative to license versus unlicensed, but you tell us.
If in the meetings it was basically brought forward, it was brought forward by the commissioner's office, and I don't know all the whys and wherefores why, but that's where it came out of.
Ms. Scott?
The reason that it was brought forth again is to make sure that the individuals that are being provided care through workers' compensation are receiving it from a licensed practitioner under the care of a licensed practitioner. We believe that that's important in order to be able to ensure consistency of service and to be able to ensure recovery.
Thank you, Ms. Todd. Are there other questions or concerns from members of the committee? And Representative Nelson, by the way, I know that we're probably remiss if we don't take note of the fact, I know you've been working on this for months and months, it is a precarious and fine balance among a wide variety of interests. Now, having said that, now I am going to poke you a little bit, because the testimony that's been presented, I think, is reasonable testimony. If as you, there will be more of these bills that come forward in the future where that balance is again trying to be achieved. If you could try to keep that testimony in mind in a keen sense as you, because I suspect you're now going to be the author on this bill and these future bills, the progeny of this bill that come. I know that the testimony was valuable to those that have heard it and received comments from members of the community that were not covered. And I know you drew the line with respect to license versus unlicensed, but it is a very viable concern to have made. And Representative Nelson, I have received the amendment. I think the safest thing, since we don't have the current version in front of us that passed out of the division, is what I would like to do is, lo and behold, Representative Nelson, perhaps we do. That on line 23.5, you referenced the reviser's instructions.
Yes.
So members, just so we're clear, the motion is with respect to the first committee engrossment. It's entitled in the upper right-hand corner, CEH 3566-1. That is the House file that the chair has moved and recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Unless there is further discussion, seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Representative Nelson, thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Passes.
Thank
you. Appreciate all your work. It is my understanding that the other Dolly Bill 3224, Representative Gunther's bill, is also ready to proceed. The chair will move House File 3224 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations. Representative Gunther, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 3224 is brought to us by the simple fact that we didn't have enough T-foiler engineers. And this has been a work in progress. We had a committee, advisory board of people made up from MinSkew, from the various ethanol plants, representing the soybean processors, power generators, business owners, boilers union, representing licensed engineers, food processing, petroleum industry, and paper manufacturers. And we also had Joe Amato representing the state as the chief boiler inspector of the state. This is a bill that will open up having high-pressure boiler engineers to take and make up the needed numbers we have for business and industry to flourish and prosper in Minnesota. We would not be able to have various companies open their doors without providing more chief engineers or first-class and second-class, as this bill says, to get this gap made up. And the number one issue as far as MPR and Humphrey Institute was jobs, and jobs certainly is rearing its ugly head. We need to get more people working, and this will do that. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Joe Amato, Minnesota's Chief Boiler Inspector and from Labor and Industry.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. Mr. Amato, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can you present your testimony, please?
Mr. Chairman, we have an A1 amendment that I think we should probably get done first. I think it's passed out or being passed out. And it took care of a plethora of needs that we had. Anita, I think that you could kind of go through the amendment for us, please.
Why don't Ms. Newman? I'll move then. It would be the H3224A1A amendment to put it in the shape in which the author desires to move with it, and then we'll go with Ms. Newman's explanation of it. All in favor of the A1A amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Davis.
Mr. Chair, the A1A amendment undoes some of the work of the Labor and Consumer Protection Committee yesterday, and I'd like to speak to the authors to the rationale behind that before we vote on the amendment, if we could.
Let's put this, Representative Abney, then before we, I will move it. We won't vote on it yet. We'll take some discussion. Let's have Ms. Newman go through it, Ms. Newman, in conjunction with the author and whoever else desires to talk of it, and then Representative Abney will make sure that we address your concerns. Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what you have in your package is the bill is introduced. There is a committee engrossment that I don't believe is posted on a public website, which is why it wasn't pulled and put into your packet. The amendment is to the committee engrossment, which reflects the changes made in the Labor and Consumer Protection Subcommittee the other day. What the amendment does is, under the licensing portion for hobby engines, steam farm tractors, the word steam was stricken, and the department has said they need steam to be reinstated in that licensing provision for steam farm traction engines and show engines. So that's the first part. Under the licensure requirement in 181.501, the original bill allowed for a provisional license for boiler operators, and the department has said that they need to make it clear that we're talking about high-pressure boiler plants rather than school boilers and things like that. So this amendment clarifies that the provisional license is to allow an employee at a high-pressure boiler plant to work under this provisional license.
Representative Mahoney.
Ms. Newman, could you tell me where I'm trying to follow you, and if you, I get some help trying to figure out where this is in the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, on the original bill, which is in your packet, it would be to section. Mr. Chair and members, it was the first part of the amendment is to a section that was added in the division, so it's not in the original bill that you have.
Okay, you, Representative Mahoney, are you clear with respect to where we're at? Are you clear enough?
I'm starting to follow it.
All right.
I didn't quite get that first page one, line eight, and then when you said it was to the bill that was that we don't have.
It's to the Committee on Girls' Center.
Okay.
The second part where the department wants to specify that they're high-pressure boilers, if you look at your original bill, it is in Section 2. It's in section, page 2, rather, line 16. On the original bill, Mr. Chair members, I'm sorry, it's page 1, line 21 of the original bill, you would put high pressure before boiler plant. Mr. Chair and members, the last part of the amendment on the original bill was on page 5, beginning on line 14. And this is where in division there was concern that by dropping the age for a special engineer's license to 16, there needed to be something qualifying that it had to be a person that was enrolled in a boiler course, because that's what the department's rationale was. So the language that you have in front of you clarifies that if you're at least 16 and under 18, you can get a special engineer's license if you're enrolled in a course approved by the commissioner.
Okay. Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, is the commissioner in this? If the commissioner would come to, if, well, perhaps to the author, why the change from yesterday and what's the difference between an accredited public or private post-secondary institution course and a course approved by the commissioner? Maybe that's the question.
I think the only reason that we would have anybody 16 enrolled in an approved boiler course is because of post-secondary options in school. Other than that, I can't foresee a 16-year-old enrolling in any class approved by the commissioner. And that's why it's there. We don't want to say that a 16-year-old student taking post-secondary options cannot be enrolled in a approved boiler class and studying to be a boiler. We certainly want to have anybody that wants to pursue a position in the trades to be able to do that.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gunther, where might I take an approved boiler class except at an accredited public or private post-secondary institution?
Representative Gunther or Ms. Mullen?
Mr. Chairman, if I may. Joel Amato. This was a request by Minsky College instructors from Riverland Community College, Minnesota West Colleges, to allow people that were in high school yet and under the age of 18 to participate in building utilities classes and gain operating experience towards a higher class license. But with it set at 18, they could not do that. So I realized that this was designed for a small group of individuals, but we're trying to accommodate them so that they can become boiler operators.
Thank you, Mr. Amato. Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Amato, was it Riverland West? The institution you just referenced, is that a public or private post-secondary institution?
It is public, Amato.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, perhaps you can explain to me, because I'm just not getting why you're deleting the language that was added in division yesterday. And I've asked three times why the reference to public or private post-secondary institution is being deleted, and I'm not getting an answer. And if I could get one, I'd be a happier camper.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm sorry, I apologize for that, but there are other institutions out there that provide boiler training, which are private businesses, that would be acceptable to the department for providing education services to these individuals. Therefore, we aren't limiting it to just public facilities.
If you can represent me, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Mahoney to this point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, and Mr. Amato, I think what you're missing is that the explanation I would use would that in most code compliance, continuing education, it's pretty standard to have the commissioner involved in authorizing or saying that those are good or bad courses. And the reason they do that is so that the commissioner can hand that off to Mr. Amato, or I could name the other head inspectors. And so it really comes down to the head inspector saying, recommending to the commissioner that this is a course that is of good standing and does fulfill the needs of this particular license. In other instances, sometimes the boards will have that authorization. But under this particular case, where there is no board of high-pressure boilers, per se, it has to have some buck stops here. So although there are non-public and private post-secondary institutions that do this work, they are not altogether that common. But there are some out there that do it, that do have secondary classes for, particularly when you have some of the old-time steam engines that are operating on tractors and some of that old stuff. They go through a different class, somewhat through their hobby associations and stuff like that. Post-secondary, I think the more important part to that, Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney and Head Inspector Amato, is that the commissioner is, in the end, responsible to say that particular course will provide the safety that the state is asking. And no commissioner wants to wake up the next morning with his name associated with an explosion of a steam engine that killed a couple people.
Okay. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. My apologies, Mr. Romano.
Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question has to do with do you envision one group of workers now with a provisional license taking work away from another group of workers who may not be licensed and who may be part of another trade which may not be a licensed trade?
Mr. Amato, Representative Gunther.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, we don't. The boiler, chief boiler engineer, first-class boilermen, and a second-class boilerman for high-pressure boilers are the ones that have knowledge of that boiler, have knowledge of how to make sure that boiler is running safely and protecting people's lives. So I don't see anybody else that they could be taking the place of their job other than another boilerman. And what these people are going to do, there's not enough of them now. In your steel mill, there's going to be these boilers that we're hoping moves up there in your area. There's going to be boilers. If we don't have a chief boiler, that plant cannot open. And that's the dilemma we're in right now, is there's not enough of them. So in order to make it so we can have those plants open, we're making allowances for a first-class and a second-class boilerman to have knowledge of the boiler and its safe operation to be able to take care of that as long as they're working towards becoming a chief.
Representative Mansfield, are there other questions? Is there anyone else who desires to testify with respect to this item? We have the A1A amendment before us that was to put it in the shape that the author desired. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion carries. For clarity's sake, what you're getting is the what came out of the division. I believe Representative Dabney, Chairman Dabney, that was yesterday. And in fairness, I understand or I recognize that some people may get frustrated on occasion with the process that we have around here. Literally, this is coming to members right now. I apologize for that. Obviously, when you have divisions and subcommittees and so forth, and the deadline issue that we have, sometimes this is how it works. But I want to make sure that everybody's comfortable with the materials before them. Just for clarity, the chair has moved what should be noted is the CEH 3224-1 version with the amendment, which is the A1A amendment. Are there any questions about what's before the body? Is there anyone else who desires to be heard? Then the chair will renew his motion that House File 3224-1, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Gunther, Mr. Romano, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The Representative Hortman, you were kind enough to be patient. You've been first on the agenda for the last six bills that we've heard. We deeply appreciate your patience. We were, and Representative Mullery, I believe that you have an obligation as well, so I want to hear your bill next. Is that correct? All right, so if you want to be in the on-deck circle, swinging the bat, we'll be Representative Hortman, House File 2940. The chair will move that House 2940 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. My understanding is that there is an author's amendment, and I will move that author's amendment just as soon as I have it in my hand. Thanks, John. It's my understanding that that is your amendment, and I'll put it in the shape in which you desire to move forward. All right, that is the H2940BE1 amendment. The chair will move that amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Hortman, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to let Driver and Vehicle Services explain the bill to you.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Larry Olala. I'm the Municipal Department of Public Safety Driver and Vehicle Services Program Director. The purpose of this bill is to address a gap in the statute that currently allows vehicles that are older than 6 years old, if they're coming into Minnesota from another state and they have a branded title on them, that when they come to Minnesota, they're, because we don't brand vehicles older than 6 years old, they are not branded. So this is a consumer awareness issue. We want to make sure that what happens is the branding notation on a title means that the vehicle at some point in its life has attained some type of salvage status in either Minnesota or in another state. And so what we want to do is to make people aware that the vehicle had sustained significant damage at one time in the vehicle's life. The other thing that we are addressing in this bill is that the reconstructed notation on titles is not also bound by the limitation of the year.
Thank you, Mr. Olala. Are there questions for Mr. Olala? Is there anyone else who desires to testify with respect to this item? Questions or comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 2940 be recommended passed as amended and referred to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that carries. Thank you, Representative Hortman.
Sure.
Representative Knuth moves the minutes of the March 6, 2008 meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Mullery, welcome to your committee. Representative Mullery will move House File 3475 be recommended to pass and referred to the House floor. Representative Mullery, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, there's an A1 amendment to put the bill in order. It corrected, it came from the Bar Association to correct some technical legal real estate wording. And also there was the part on 126 and on is to correct a notice, and that was requested by the bankers, and that's request, and that was agreeable to everyone.
Fair enough. We have the A1 amendment before us. That's just being passed out. Representative Mullery, if you just want to walk through the bill, and then we will take the A1 amendment once everybody has it in their hands. Representative Mullery, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, this is part of the consensus for Foreclosure Crisis Intervention Act. This is one of the bills in that that came out of the working group we had this summer. And basically, everybody agreed to this from Acorn and Legal Aid through banks and brokers. And we reached a consensus on this, and it changes some of the pre-foreclosure notices. The main effect of this bill is to have it so that when the loan goes into default, the lender will notify community agencies that go and work with the mortgagors and try and help them get it out. The surveys have shown that if you don't get them out of the problem and working with them in the first 60 to 90 days, you'll probably never help them get out of it, or at least the likelihood is that they won't get out of the situation. So that's the biggest issue there. And the other one more point is that we limited some of the fees that can occur. For instance, some services were charging $200 to drive by the house every week to see it was still standing and things like that. So the fees were limited somewhat, but they were also, there's an exception for anything that's necessary to keep the house up and to community standards. And I, if there are any questions on it, Mr. Kevin Dunleavy, the real property section liaison to the legislature, is here to answer those.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mullery. Are there, first off, to the A1 amendment, Representative Mullery has moved that. Does everyone have the A1 amendment? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Mullery, or let me just ask a question. Is there anyone here that desires to testify with respect to this bill? I know we've got Ms. Dunleavy in case there's questions. So my understanding is it's not a controversial bill. Is there anyone here to testify, particularly anyone here to testify in opposition? Seeing none, are there any questions or concerns from members of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 3475 as amended be recommended passed and referred to the House floor. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries. Thank you, Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, I was quicker than you today. You promised.
I did three bills in the time it took you to do one. Thank you, Representative Mullery. House File 3129, Representative Marquardt. Cheryl moved that House File 3129 be recommended pass and refer to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. Representative Marquardt, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This last year, I have a few people here with me that if there's questions, but last year there was a platting recodification bill that dealt with Chapter 505 that passed both houses convincingly and then was signed into law by the governor. As they looked through it, they missed a few things, and this is technical in nature. It's brought to us by the Minnesota Society of Professional Land Surveyors. And no opposition from any of the groups, the cities, the counties, the Bar Association. I do have Mr. Mike Welling and Mr. Lynn Caswell here to answer any questions. I could certainly, Mr. Chair, go over some of the provisions of the bill, but for time's sake, it's whatever you would desire.
Well, let's put it in that fashion. First off, is there anyone here in opposition to the bill? Are there questions or concerns? It is a fairly straightforward technical bill. I didn't anticipate opposition, but are there any questions or concerns from members of the committee? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 3129 be recommended pass and refer to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Excellent
chair,
job.
Thank you so much.
The next bill on our agenda is House File 2100. Representative Clark, the chair will move that House File 2100 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Housing and Public Health. Representative Clark, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have an amendment that's being passed out, I believe. It's the A1 amendment.
Okay. The I'm going to move that, but I don't want to have folks act on it until everybody has it in their possession. The chair will move the A1 amendment. And Representative Clark, if you can walk us through what the bill does, taking into account the A1 amendment, since that's an author's amendment, it's traditional that that will go on.
Mr. Chairman, members, basically this bill is about phasing out two kinds of dangers that are in some of our baby products, basically phthalates and bisphenol A. And what the bill does is it sets a date for the time that they would be phased out as January 1st of 2009. And the bill basically gives a description of what phthalates are and what bisphenol A are and says that they will not be available for sale by manufacturers in our state of Minnesota after that date.
And Representative Clark, if I might just interrupt you at that point, the A1 amendment is before us. Do all members have the A1 amendment? Representative Zeller?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've got the A1, but what about the E8 and the E9?
They're not my amendments, Mr. Chair. I don't know who the amendments
are. Those are amendments that did come to the committee that are at this point not been offered, but the A1 is an author's amendment.
It's an author's amendment, Mr. Chairman. Right. It does put it in the order that I'd like it in, and I can just say, Mr. Chairman, it keeps pace with what happened in Representative Dabney's committee. He's, in that committee, there was a request to take out the findings section, so we take out the findings section and only have a description of the definition of what these products are, what these chemicals are. And we also put in some language that the beverage industry wanted us to put in. That's on line 1.8 to 1.10, so that we're it's on line 1.3 to 1.4, and it makes it clear that what we're talking about here is a product that are contained in a can except in those used for infant formulas. And that was a compromise with that industry.
All right. Well, to the A1 amendment, it's traditional in this committee that we take author's amendments that they become part of the bill. Once they become part of the bill, they obviously may prove controversial. But the A1 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, seeing none, the A1 amendment has been incorporated into the bill. Representative Clark, to the bill.
I have a couple of witnesses that I'd like to have to say a few words, and we'll be brief, but I think it'll be very helpful to the committee members. And I'd like to suggest Dr. David Wellinger to
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dr. David Wallinger. I'm a physician, went to medical school at the university here in Minnesota, have a master's degree from Princeton University, and I currently serve on the Board of Scientific Counselors for the Centers for Disease Control, and I wanted to just give a few words about the health concerns around the two classes of chemicals that we're talking about in this bill, bisphenol A and phthalates. These two classes are both hormone-disrupting chemicals to which the American population is widely exposed. About 95% of the American population has bisphenol A in their blood or urine, as determined by the Centers for Disease Control. And infants, according to one recent study, have 7 or more phthalates detectable in their urine. And the concern about these chemicals is established across hundreds of studies, literally, and they stem from the fact that there is a consistent array of findings associated in those studies with the ability of these chemicals to disrupt hormone function. This is of greatest concern for pregnant women and young children and fetuses, because hormones are really quite involved in the development of the human body, including the brain, the gonads, and other reproductive tract functions. And finally, they're concerned because hormones are designed to act at very low levels in the human body. And so even though the exposures to these chemicals through their use in products and in the environment are very low at the part per billion level, these are the levels at which these effects occur, according to these hundreds of studies that I'm talking about. So I want to just mention one recent study. It was a NIH, sponsored in part by the NIH. It was a consensus statement coming out of a panel in Chapel Hill around bisphenol A. And after looking at the literature on bisphenol A, I want to read you what the consensus of the majority of that panel was.
Sir, if I can interrupt for just a moment.
Yes, sir.
Representative Clark, you indicated to me you did have a witness that needed to leave relatively soon.
Yes, sir.
All right. I just wanted to ensure that we were hearing from the... We're going to break here in about 7 minutes so that we can get to the floor.
I have children playing with plastic toys at daycare, so got to go pick them up. So this consensus panel in 2006 November said the wide range of adverse effects at low levels of bisphenol A in laboratory animals exposed both during development and in adulthood is a great cause for concern with regard to the potential for similar adverse effects in humans. And they went on to note that the kinds of adverse effects they're concerned about in humans, many of them are common or increasing in the human population. There are things like prostate and breast cancer, urogenital abnormalities in male infants, a decline in semen quality, early puberty onset, and neurobehavioral problems like ADHD. And so, and finally, I just want to summarize another survey of the literature of bisphenol A done by the University of Missouri Endocrine Disruptor Group. They looked at 176 different studies done prior to October of 2006. Of those that were government-funded, 149 of the 163 government-funded studies, or 93%, found harm from these low-level exposures. 14 found no harm. And those 149 of those 176 studies represent the vast majority. So just wanted to make that point that the overwhelming consensus of these government-funded studies is that there are effects of concern at low levels seen both in animals and in humans.
Hi there, my name is Julia Nurbin, and I'm a professor in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at the University of Minnesota. And this is my daughter, Clara.
I grew up for you.
She's the youngest testifier here today, I think.
We've heard plenty from her.
Yeah, you have. I'm sorry. See, you're glad that we're leaving now, right?
But she's as articulate as most legislators, I think. So.
She's here really to sort of give you a visual and show you that babies really do put everything in their mouth. And I had two little sippy cup lids that are very highly chewed on, and I'll just ask you guys to guess whether these have bisphenol A in them. And I just want to say that as a parent, even as a professional who understands a lot about endocrine disruption and science, I don't have the time to spend my life going and researching every single product that I pick up at Target or at Babies R Us or anywhere else. And so I'm really counting on the state of Minnesota to make it my life a little bit easier and make it so that I can go and feel comfortable that I'm buying something safe for my baby. So thanks.
Thank you.
Just one last comment and then we'll be done.
All right, Representative Clark.
I guess we'll just field questions maybe at this point.
And one notable item is that there was, I don't know if it's true or not, the bill as moved would go to the Public Health Committee. It's my understanding that Representative Thiessen's committee may have some interest in seeing it, but we won't move it there.
Okay.
We'll have to confirm whether or not his committee needs to see it.
Okay.
Are there questions or concerns for the folks that have testified thus far? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, and I'm sorry, I just what was your name again?
Dr. Wallinger.
Dr. Wallinger, can you tell me how long these chemicals have been used?
Dr. Wallinger?
For literally decades, bisphenol A, for example, was first synthesized in 1891. It was found in an early study in 1936 to disrupt hormone function in a rat study. But nevertheless, it was started to be used very widely in manufacturing polycarbonate plastic starting in the 1950s, and now we produce about 6 billion pounds of it worldwide per year.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Wallinger, how long have these chemicals been used in children's products?
Dr. Wallinger.
Well, I couldn't tell you exactly because they're used in a very wide range of products, but, you know, certainly for years.
Okay. Representative Anderson?
And then on the studies, you were talking about the animal exposures. Are these animals being directly injected with these chemicals, or how are they being exposed to the chemicals?
Dr. Willinger?
Well, I think it would be difficult to characterize across. I mean, for example, with bisphenol A, we're literally talking 150 to 200 different studies. So the route of administration would vary from study to study.
Okay. Representative Anderson, anything further?
Not for now.
Okay. Is there anyone else that has questions or concerns for Representative Clark at this time or for the folks that have provided testimony thus far? If not, I think what we're going to do, we've got to get over to the House floor for, I'm told, just a matter of moving some papers. So my sense is that should take about 15 minutes or so. I'd like to gather again about 6 o'clock. Well, not about 6 o'clock. We'll gather again at 6 o'clock. Because I know how folks tend to wander around. But we'll get back together at 6 o'clock and resume with House File 2100. Members, we're going to get back underway again. To folks that have given us their time this afternoon, we greatly appreciate your patience with us. As we move towards deadline, it does get a little bit busy this time of year, and we had a floor session that unfortunately took a little bit longer. So I apologize for the delay. Representative Clark, I just wanted to, we have a little clerical issue, and that is that we want to make sure that we're working off of the most recent bill, which is the one that came out of the last stop, and then we had the amendments that went on redrafted so that it's up to date with the current bill. So with that, members, I would move to reconsider the House File 2100 and the amendments. The A1 amendment. All in favor say aye. Any opposed? All right, that brings it back before us. With that, I would now move what would be the latest version of House File 2100. For your reference, it's coded in the upper right-hand corner as CEH 2100. I would move that with the be recommended passed and be referred to the Committee on Housing and Public Health. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
I'm sorry, folks. I should have asked for the amendment first to put it in the shape. So we'll move back to the A2 amendment. That will put it in the shape in which the author desires to proceed. All in favor of the A2 amendment? Say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none. Thank you for your understanding. With respect to that, Representative Clark, the appropriate bill with the appropriate amendment is now before the committee. You had some folks testify. Does that conclude the testimony by the proponent?
Almost, Mr. Chair. I actually was approached by the beverage industry. They want to add 2 more words to the amendment that we agreed to put on, and I see no problem with it. If we could do that, Mr. Chairman, I'm willing to do it. It would be on the new amendment, A2, line 1.3, where it says, other than a food product, after food, please insert or beverage.
All right.
That gives comfort to the beverage industry, apparently, so it's fine.
All right. Thank you, Representative Clark. That puts it in the shape in which you wish to proceed. The chair will move then that the A2 amendment, which has been passed, the amendment on line 1.3 to add the words or beverage after the word food. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Clark, anything further to the bill?
No, I think we'll just turn to questions, and I know there's some other people who want to talk.
All right, thank you, Representative Clark. I think what we'll do is take the balance of the testimony from whomever it may be coming, and then we'll stand for questions. Is there anyone else who desires to be heard with respect to House File 2100 as amended? Yes, sir. Good evening. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
If you can just identify who you are and proceed with the testimony.
Excuse me. My name is Rob Harriet. I'm with the Toy Industry Association, and I'm here today to talk with you about the legislation before the committee. I'd like to just do a couple things real quick. One, tell you a little bit about CIA and what their focus is. And then, excuse me, and then tell you why these two ingredients that are being proposed to be banned or limited are needed within our industry. TIA is an association made up of the U.S. toy manufacturers. We have about 500 members, most of which are fairly small companies. We certainly represent the household name brands, if you will, but beyond that, we probably have 490 other members you've never heard of. TIA is focused on toy safety first. We have two real main functions. One is ensuring that toys on the market are safe through the consensus standard making process, the ASTM process, and second, we also do fairly large trade shows each year. So I say that to emphasize that we work on safety issues. And the reason that these two ingredients are important to us is for that very reason. Phthalate, specifically DINP and bisphenol A, are two primary safety ingredients in toys. Without them, toys can shatter, are not pliable, can break, and the greatest hazard in the toy industry is choking hazards. And if you take DINP out and you disallow flexibility in toys, you can have those toys break. You have small part hazards, and that can turn into a choking hazard. Same thing with bisphenol A. It's a shatter-resistant ingredient, so that when you have the harder plastics, they don't shatter and, again, create that choking hazard. I want to note that at TIA, many of us are parents ourselves. I know the lady that was here earlier had a child with her. I myself am a father. I'd probably say 90% of people in our group are parents. So I don't think that we would ever recommend anything to this committee that would in any way harm our own children. In fact, we do a lot of research to ensure what we're doing not only protects our children, but all the other children that our products go to. Let me kind of answer a question of why these two specific ingredients. Many people say, well, aren't there alternatives to DINP or to bisphenol A? I'll readily admit there's some alternatives out there, but there are no alternatives that have been proven safe for 50 years, have been in use in the marketplace for 50 years, that have been okayed by the CPSC, okayed by the European Union, the scientists of the European Union, I'll say. And in the case of bisphenol A, it's been approved by the FDA for contact with food, so I think that also emphasizes its safety use. with that, the only thing I'll add, and I want to be brief, my voice isn't going to hold up much longer anyway, you see some limitations on phthalates starting to crop up around the country. I would assert to you that those bans are not based on the science. And bisphenol A specifically has not been banned anywhere on the planet. When TIA looks at the ingredients that go into the manufacturer's toys, what we look for is the best ingredients. We don't say, okay, maybe we'll use this because it's more cost-effective or that. TIA is not a manufacturer of either of the products. It's only in our best interest to use what's best. And the government agencies that I've already named have said that this is the most proven safe product out there. TIA itself, because we feel that we not only have to be sure, we have to be double and triple sure that what we're using in our products is safe. We have actually even commissioned a study for ourselves on DINP phthalate to make sure that there was no scientific evidence out there that would suggest it's unsafe to use our products. And in short, that study came back. It was what we call the study of studies. That study came back and said that there were no scientific studies out there that suggested DINP should not be used as it's used currently. So I'll leave it at that. Certainly some of the more experts in this area, toxicologists and chemists and such, will speak to you on some of the ingredients and how they're made up and why they're safe and some of the studies a little more in depth, but certainly available for questions at the appropriate time.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak on the science supporting the safety of bisphenol A.
I am Dr. Julie Goodman. I'm a board-certified toxicologist at Gradient Corporation, which is an environmental consulting firm headquartered in Cambridge, Mass. After receiving a B.S. in environmental engineering from MIT, I received a science master's in epidemiology and a Ph.D. in toxicology from Johns Hopkins. And before joining Gradient, I was a cancer prevention fellow at the National Cancer Institute. My comments today are my own, but my participation is supported by the American Chemistry Council. So, earlier, you heard about a select group of studies and the conclusions of a panel of scientists who convened in Chapel Hill. But what the proponents of this bill failed to mention was that every other scientific and government agency in the world, which I am aware, has come to the conclusion that bisphenol A is safe. To the best of my knowledge, these groups have reviewed the exact same studies you heard about and that were reviewed by the Chapel Hill panel. This included both studies funded by industry and studies funded by government. And they all found that current uses of bisphenol A are safe. So, I don't know if you want to read through them all, but I'll just pass them around so you can see. There's been a lot of work done on this, and I'll just mention a few. In 2008, NSF International found that based on available studies, current exposure levels are safe. In 2007, the European Food Safety Agency, or EFSA, they evaluated the safety of bisphenol A with a panel of 21 independent scientists from the EU, mostly from academia, with no industry input. And in their January 2007 report, they evaluated many exposure scenarios, which included the use of baby bottles. And they not only found that current uses of bisphenol A are safe, but they actually increased by a factor of 5 what they considered to be the safe level of bisphenol A because of all the new available data. So that is, over time, they found bisphenol A is actually safer, not more dangerous, than they originally thought. And similar conclusions were reached by other agencies in that notebook, including FDA and the Japanese Ministry of the Environment. Bisphenol A is not banned anywhere in the world. So I personally have been part of 2 8-member expert panels, which over the last 3 years have been tasked with critically reviewing every published peer-reviewed study that examined the potential for bisphenol A to cause reproductive and developmental effects at low doses. The analysis from the first panel was peer-reviewed and published in the journal Critical Reviews in Toxicology in 2006, and the updated analysis from the second panel, which includes studies published through January of this year, was submitted last month to the same journal, and we came to the same conclusions as these government bodies I just discussed. In both cases, we found that the very low levels of bisphenol A to which humans are exposed are safe. So the question is, how did the Chapel Hill panel come to such different conclusions as these panels around the world? Essentially, they did not conduct a complete weight of evidence evaluation. They selectively examined data from certain individual studies in isolation, and if one thing was reported to be affected at some dose or some time point, they said the study is evidence of harm. In reality, if something is not consistently affected in a study, then that study does not actually provide evidence of harm. In addition, the panel didn't consider results from all studies together. When robust studies found no evidence of harm, the panel ignored them completely. One should not ignore any data, positive or negative, in determining whether a chemical is safe. So taken together, based on a weight of evidence evaluation and consistent with agencies around the world, current uses of bisphenol A are safe.
Thank you, Dr. Spindler. Good evening. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Karen Schmidt. I'm here to testify on behalf of the American Chemistry Council phthalate esters panel, and my testimony will focus on phthalate esters, another component of the proposed Bill 2100 today. Most of you may already know what phthalate esters are, but some of you don't, so I'd like to briefly review that with you. Phthalate esters are used to plasticize or soften vinyl. And as many of you may know, vinyl is used in a wide, wide variety of consumer uses, including children's uses. It is the thing. It makes the little booties that are water repellent. It makes those wonderful crib liners that repel the little nasties that happen in the middle of the night, which many of you parents are familiar with. Raincoats, the little top that goes across the bassinet, or that you would take out your child if you went out in a stroller. Toys of all kinds. Little sleep mats, and all kinds of other things that children would use and use every day. Some of these products are intended to be mouthed by children. Some of them aren't. And as you've heard earlier, the primary phthalate that's used to plasticize children's toys is a phthalate called DINT, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a minute.
There's not just one phthalate, but there's a family of them. And each one of these is a totally separate chemical that has been tested separately and has different toxicological properties. So in many regards, it's unfair to bundle them all together and make assumptions about how each one of these phthalate esters will function. This is important to recognize because the phthalate that's been used in children's toys, primarily DINT, has been extensively reviewed, which I'll talk about in a minute. Phthalate esters have been used to make vinyl soft for up to 50 years, which means that most of us use them either when we were children or use them with your own children in a wide variety of products. Because they've been used for about 50 years, they've been extensively tested. Just like Dr. Goodman handed out her three-ring binder, the family of phthalate esters have been tested well over 1,000 times in a variety of studies. Some of those are conducted by industry. Many of those have been conducted by other scientists all across the world. So the body of evidence for supporting the safety of phthalate esters in various applications is extremely strong and has a very, very long track record. Some of the most important studies that have been conducted, certain scientific reviews have been conducted by government bodies. One of the most important was a recent conclusion by Europe, of all places, which recently concluded that DINT is safe for use in children's toys and children's products. The conclusion of that review specifically concluded that it is safe for use for children and for infants. So that's extremely important. You should also know that the Centers for Disease Control has, in the last decade or so, compiled a substantial amount of actual real-world data on biomonitoring data to determine how much various phthalate esters normal folks, the average population, is exposed to. That data has been extremely useful because when coupled with toxicological data, it enables scientists to determine that real-world exposures to phthalate esters are well within government-set safety margins, often called reference doses. Those are set by EPA. So once again, this gives the average consumer a great deal of comfort that exposures, everyday exposures to normal products are well within safety margins. The most important study for purposes of this committee's review is the review conducted by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. The results were announced in 2003. This culminated a five-year review of the safety of phthalates in children's toys with primary focus, again, on DINT. The reason that study is so important is that a number of groups had expressly asked the regulatory agency with authority over the safety of toys, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, to take a close look at the safety of vinyl toys using phthalates. The commission conducted an initial review, and then that wasn't enough. They then referred the matter to the CAP, which was a separate committee that actually explored the real-world mouthing habits of small children. So that group actually took small children to determine how long an average child would mouth a particular product a day. Up before that CAP committee convened, many of the scientific estimates on exposure were just guesses. But since the CPSC reviewed the matter, we now have real data on how much children actually mouth their toys. Using that data, the CPSC was able to conclude in 2003 that there's no demonstrated health risk from these products. And that is extremely important. That was mouthing behavior of products that children actually would put in their mouths. One of the allegations that phthalate esters often see is that there's concern, which is understandable with parents, that phthalate esters may function as something called an endocrine disruptor. There isn't a scientific basis for thinking that that's the case, however. There have been some studies in rodents where there have been some adverse effects seen for certain phthalates at extremely high doses. There is no human data, however, no reliable human data to suggest that the same is the case in humans. You all should know, since you do this, do these sorts of hearings all the time, that when rodents occur, the rodents are dosed at higher and higher and higher levels until an effect is actually seen in the rodent. That's how government agencies set a safe dose. And that, in fact, has occurred with phthalate esters, and the EPA and others have set safe doses for these particular compounds. One of the most recent human studies that has again caused a stir was one that recently was conducted by Dr. Shauna Swan. Dr. Swan conducted a study in which she sought to correlate the genitalia of young infant boys with exposures that their mothers had had before the children were born. Unfortunately, that study has been heavily rebuked and debunked in the scientific literature, including by statisticians. One of the criticisms of that study was that Dr. Swan created something called the anogenital distance, which is a measurement which in rodents does have some relevance to reproductive effects. In humans, however, there is no such measure. So she attempted to correlate a finding in rodents to one where there's no such finding recognized in human beings. An additional significant point to make is that that study has gotten a lot of bad press. Dr. Swan was very clear in reaching her conclusion that that study found no frank genital defects in the children who were studied, and no, forgive me for saying this, no changes to the young male penis. Sometimes we've got to get into these things in these hearings, but extremely important information. That's one where the snowball just kind of went down the hill and a lot of people got concerned, where the study itself doesn't support the concern. A couple other quick points. I do want to remind everybody that when there's concern about what a particular product is, especially if that concern relates to plastic, it's very easy for the average consumer to determine, in most cases, what type of plastics they're using. I did pay attention when Clara expressed concern about her sippy cup earlier. And sippy cup, in all likelihood, I'm guessing, is a polyethylene or a polypropylene. But as many of you will remember from the days of recycling, it's pretty easy to turn over most products to determine what it's made of. And there is a code for polyvinyl chloride or PVC, which is readily available. If a product contains phthalate esters or vinyl, that code appears on the product. And there's also a code that would encompass polycarbonate plastic. So it's actually relatively easy for the average educated adult to determine what type of plastic they're purchasing already without the need for any further legislative action. I do have written testimony. I'd be happy to hand that out to you following the discussion today. And I'd like to close by quoting one of my favorite politicians, Governor Schwarzenegger. As many of you probably know,
If you're going to quote him, you've got to impersonate him, too.
Well, I can't quote him. I could try. I'll be back. I hope I won't be back. As most of you know, California did recently pass a ban on some phthalates in children's products, and that bill was not founded on science, and the governor himself recognized that. So I have to give him credit for recognizing his error. He said, "I do not believe that addressing this type of concern in the legislature on a chemical-by-chemical, product-by-product basis is the best or most effective way to make chemical policy in California." He called for a systematic way to address these types of concerns. I would encourage this state, which is an environmental leader and not an environmental lemming, not to follow the lead of California and not to fall into the same trap of making a decision which is not based on good science.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Mm-hmm. Just a moment off this bill, I wanted to make a couple quick announcements relative to developments on our agenda. The one is House File 635. The plan is that is now going to be laid over. There's still further work that's being done on that. And I just, if folks are sitting here that are waiting hearing with respect to that, the outdoor sports is another bill, 3907. My understanding is that actually there's a related bill that is going to be acted on rather than 3907, and that one is making some progress. So we are not going to. And if you have any questions relative to that, Representative Lilly is the chief author, so feel free to visit with him regarding the developments on that bill. Finally, just by a show of hands, is the 3391 is Representative Huntley's bill regarding health care issues. Who's here on that bill? All right, so see what I have to work with around here?
So well.
My Representative Huntley, it's my understanding as far as his availability goes is that he will be available very soon. My intent is to take his bill just by, you know, out of deference to the number of people that are here on that bill, just as soon as he's able to get here. In the meantime, probably Representative Beard is in the room. Representative Lesch both have very brief bills, and my hope would be to hear their bills and then go immediately to Representative Huntley. So if there's folks that are waiting for those, I recognize that you might have other places you'd like to be this evening. I am sorry to have interrupted. Is there any additional testimony that you wish to provide or are here to answer questions or concerns we may have?
Yeah, actually, if I could add one point, the Swan study that was mentioned, I'd like to call out the fact that, again, DINT is the phthalate used in toys, and the Swan study did not even study DINT. It studied other phthalates, but not DINT. So if you're going to make a correlation between children's products and phthalates that go in them and not even study the one that is in the product, I think from our perspective of the toy industry, that's certainly a pretty dramatic fallacy in the study.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much for your testimony. Representative Knuth?
Are you taking questions, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Okay. Quick ones. First, on the comment, I would agree with Governor Schwarzenegger's comment that we'd like some more federal leadership on this issue, but just the last federal toxic law that was signed into law by Governor Ford a significant amount of time before I was even born. So I think we've been waiting to get that federal leadership. But just a question for Dr. Goodman. I was looking through your studies and noticed you had authored some of those, and just, you work for the Gradient Corporation, but I noticed that a lot of the studies were funded by the American Plastics Council, and I think given honoraria to the people in academic circles. So I just was wondering if that, where the funding for the studies had come from.
Dr. Goodman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the American Chemistry Council funded the review that we made, but they did not fund most of the studies actually in that review.
Representative Knuth.
I'm just looking to the not the review study, but several of the studies that you authored in that. I'm assuming that's you who's authored several of those studies. I got asked for the book, so I had to keep passing it on. But I noticed three or four.
We'll return it to you, Representative. No one else has laid claim to it, Representative Knuth. If you'd like to take
I'm
it
very
with
interested.
You, more power to you.
I just wanted to be clear on that point of who had funded those studies.
Dr. Goodman.
Mr. Chair, there are two peer-reviewed studies on which I participated. As I mentioned, one of them was peer-reviewed by people that, as far as I know, have nothing to do with the American Chemistry Council. The other one we just submitted for peer review. And yes, both those studies were funded by the American Chemistry Council. But the majority of studies in there are from other agencies around the world, most of them government.
Other quick to that. From our perspective, we don't manufacture these chemicals. We don't study them. I'm not smart enough to study them. But we do.
Sure, we got a book for you.
But what we do in our industry, again, is double check and triple check that the ingredients we're putting in our product is safe for children. So whether it's ACC or NGO studies, we look at it all. And what we base our decisions on is CCSC said it was okay. The EU scientists have said it is okay. The FDA has said it's okay. So we look at it in a whole. So. And we don't have a financial tie, or nobody funds our studies other than, you know, us. So, you know, impugning the study because of who pays for it, I don't know is the right way to go, because we don't look at that.
Fair comment. Are there other questions from members of the committee, either for the opponents or the proponents, or is there anyone else who desires to be testified or to testify with respect to this bill? All right. If not, the chair will redo his motion that House Bill 2100. I'm sorry, Representative Simpson.
Well, I just had a couple of questions due to the fact that it is a Commerce Committee, and this is very interesting, and I'm sure the Health Committee have listened to hours of it. About just commerce related, is this if we ban this in the state of Minnesota, will the products be available for people to buy? And what's the cost going to be? And how is California reacting to the fact that they have it banned there?
Representative Simpson, should we, if the author would return to
maybe
the
author
could
best
her,
answer those.
Her bill.
Yeah.
And I assume one of you would like to weigh in on this question as well. So if we can just do a point counterpoint and. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're not dealing with the retail end of this. We're dealing with the manufactured end of it and only with new products. And actually, we have some receipts. I think the question was the cost. We have some receipts. Actually, I'm going to ask Ms. to share this. Apparently, you know, it's actually cheaper in some cases to buy the alternative product. And you can look at the receipts that are going by. Maybe you could just put into that information. Okay.
Thank you. Welcome back.
There's a lot of us up here. Hello, my name is Lindsay Dahl. I'm the coordinator for Healthy Legacy, and I just want to address what you had to say about California. California is the fourth largest economy in the world, and because of the phthalate ban that passed in October, manufacturers are already reconfiguring to make phthalate-free toys.
Thank you. And folks from that are, have testified in opposition to the bill?
Yeah. Let me address that. I think that that's potentially correct, that sometimes it may be cheaper to have an alternative. That's not our point. There's nothing out there that's safer than this stuff. So if you want a cheaper, less safe alternative, then that's what we're looking at. If you want the safest product, regardless of cost, then banning or limiting DINP and FLA is not the way to go. So we look at it from a safety issue, regardless of what cost it. And I would do that.
Yes, fair enough. Representative Simpson, do you have any follow-up with respect to that?
No, not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Simpson. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a new mother that has to purchase a lot of these items, I think that it will increase costs. Even if you have these alternatives that are available to you, that doesn't mean that the company that you choose to buy your products from are going to have those types of plastics available. You know, there's mothers that are very particular about what kind of bottles that they buy for their baby because their baby will only drink from one certain bottle. Believe me, I went through 4 months of trying to figure out what bottle would work for my baby, and it was not fun. And I wound up paying $3.99 for one nipple. That's just one nipple. The bottles themselves are $12.99. Okay, so you're going to tell me that you're going to increase the cost for that on top of everything else that you have to do with, you know, caring for your child? Now, that aside, I'm all about looking after my child, and I want what's best and what's safe for them. I think today you have not proven that there is a problem with these products. I think the scientific evidence, the peer reviews that have been done time and time again, and the fact that you amended your own bill to allow it that we can have it in our food. Well, if it's okay for us, why isn't it okay for everything else? I mean, to me, that's just, you know, counter to what you have been saying and laying out in your argument for this. If I just look at time. We've had these products for 50 years, 50 years that we've had these products, and according to the studies and the comments that you made here today, we would not have any genders here around this committee. We would all be neutral based upon the comments that have been made to me about how these endocrine disruptors are going to impact us. And I just feel that what we are doing here today is actually opening ourselves up to products that are untested, and that we will be here 10 years from now saying, oops, we made a mistake. And I guess I'd rather go with the products that are time-tested and that I can feel comfortable that my child has available to them. Those are my comments.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Dellert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to one of our doctors. Of the California new products or phthalate-free or whatever they may be, what is the testing, what is the research, what is the peer review that's been done on those new products that we're replacing? Or the new products that are replacing these, all the two we're banning in this bill?
To the extent you're still qualified to answer.
Mr. Chairman, any new chemical product that comes onto the market would need to comply with cost requirements and would meet minimum standards for testing. What would be missing, of course, would be 50 years of accumulate, of big volume of accumulated testing, of peer-reviewed published studies. And it's that large, large volume of substantiation, of retesting, of delving into minutia that really allows tremendous comfort with the products that are currently on the market. So we don't mean to suggest or imply that a new product might be less safe, more safe, equally safe. The point is that we know that the safety profile of the products on the market now, bisphenol A and phthalate esters, are extraordinarily sound and extremely well tested. So it makes no sense to remove those products from the market and inject a question mark. California is an experiment right now. We don't know what the result will be. It's unclear right now whether the products that are using substitutes will last as long, will perform as well, will break. It's unclear. So one could argue that it might be better to let California run its pilot and see how things work before Minnesota adopts a similar practice.
The point being that we're going to take something out of whole cloth and put it in as a new safe, again, applying the same standards that have been applied to the two products we're going to ban, seems exactly what we're supposed to do, right? We've already got something that's been approved, and we're going to reapprove it. Mr. Chairman and to Representative Clark, I appreciate the bill, and as a dad of two small kids, yes, I fully know exactly what happens with new things that come into our house. Either they, go in the dog's mouth or the kid's mouth, depending on who gets to it first. The point here being is we're going to ban something. We're going to set Minnesota up as an island, and a lot of these issues we're going to make less safe products or untested products available to our parents and kids. And Mr. Chairman, I appreciate you giving a hearing, but this would be something we'd probably recommend that the governor review, but veto should it get passed the legislative body.
Thank you, Representative Zeller. Are there additional comments? Otherwise, I appreciate the considerable and valuable testimony on behalf of both sides, and I think it was well done and informative, and we've even been left with a large book. With that, though, I think folks are probably fully informed and ready to vote, so the chair will renew his motion. That's House File 2100, and it's, just so we're clear, it's CEH 2100-1, which is the most recent version, as amended with the A2 amendment, that motion is renewed, that the be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Health. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
That motion carries. Thank you all very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
We're going to do Representative Beard's bill next, and then Representative Lesh, and then I hope and I believe that Representative Huntley will be available, and we'll take that bill after that. Representative Beard, I am looking for your bill. Representative Zeller's moved House File 3327 be recommended. I'm sorry, actually, this came through telecom. And Representative Johnson will move that House File 3327 be recommended to pass and referred to the House floor. Representative Beard, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be here. It's fun to stand around listening to the riveting testimony and the issues you must wrestle with. This is not nearly as riveting, nor as in-depth or detailed. It's an alternative form of regulation plan. The bill, as modified by Chair Johnson's committee, allows mid-sized telephone companies to opt into an alternative form of regulation. Once they cross 50,000 subscriber lines, they qualify to be mid-sized telephone companies. There are currently three of them in the state members, and they can take advantage of a plan called A4, Alternative Form of Regulation. Several years ago, members, the legislature enacted that plan on a kind of an experimental or pilot basis for Quest, the largest carrier in the state. It's a way that they could compete with, frankly, with these things, cell phones, which are not regulated by the state, in which are eating our wireline carriers for breakfast, and they couldn't just go out and lower their prices, however, since their rate of recovery regulated. The Attorney General, the Department of Commerce, and the PUC all have to sign off on any plan to change price, even if it is downward, even if it's a service change that increases service and things like that. So we allowed Quest to experiment with a thing called an alternative form of regulation. It's run now for several years. The wings have not fallen off. Indeed, it's been a remarkably successful plan by all accounts for the consumers and for the telephone company. Everybody seems to be enjoying the benefits of the alternative form of regulation. And so the mid-sized telephone companies, headed by our friends at Frontier and represented by Ms. Joanne Johnson here beside me, have asked if they could be included in that. The Telecommunications Subcommittee a couple weeks ago agreed unanimously that we could. You actually have House File 3327, the committee engrossment, Mr. Chairman, just there was a little confusion about which piece of paper we're working with. It's actually the 3327-1 bill we're proposing to pass here tonight. If you'd like, I do have Joanne with me to talk a little bit about some of her things.
Excellent.
Or we could just pass the bill.
I was going to suggest we hold the telecom division in high regard. It sounds like it came out of there unanimously. I'm not aware of any opposition. If there is any opposition, now is the time to appear. Seeing none, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 3327, specifically the H3327-DE1, which came out of the division, be recommended pass and referred to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you very much, Representative Beard. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Next up is Representative Lesch's bill. It's House File 3790. The chair will move that House File 3790 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. There is an amendment, Representative Lesch. Is that...
Mr. Chair, I'd ask the amendment be moved to an author's amendment.
The chair will move the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that puts it in the shape the author desires to move forward. Representative Lesch, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I have here with me Joel Beckman, Director of Property Taxation and Records for Dakota County, and on my left, and Michael. Oh, Michael's here. Okay, Joel's here. And then Michael Kniff, County Recorder in Hennepin County, Registrar of Titles. Members, what this bill does is essentially take what is the law in over half of Minnesota from the dark ages of recording titles to electronic recording. If people, depending on where you live here right now, it could take you anywhere from a month or two to several months in order to have your title recorded. And I recall when during the height of the transactions boom in the last 10 years, when it took 6 months in Ramsey County for me to get my documents recorded, it caused substantial problems if you wanted to do a home equity loan, any other kind of work. This essentially makes that process instantaneous and also takes what's happening throughout most of Minnesota from the pilot stage to the mainstream of real property law throughout the state. There were originally 5 pilots, and now there are
39 counties.
Now there are 39 counties that are currently doing it, members. The bill as itself has 2 parts. I'll speak to that and then speak to the author's amendment. Article 1 includes general provisions integrating e-filings into the existing real property statutes, establishes an ongoing real estate commission of stakeholders from the industry to have oversight on the computer standards, and also it provides the Real Estate Commission to coordinate its efforts with national and commercial standards. Then Article 2 provides specific changes in real property law to permit electronic filings to be on the same footing as those that are filed on paper. In 2005, Minnesota asked the county recorders to provide better service and to meet defined turnaround times. This is an important item in the toolbox that's necessary for us to meet the goals which we'll accomplish in this bill. So with that, I would speak briefly to, why don't I just let Mr. Black speak to the author's amendment, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Bert Black with the Secretary of State's office, and the reason I'm here is that the Secretary of State's office has had the organizational part of its task force and study for the last 9 years, but we don't do real estate, so we're ready to hand it off to the folks who do it. The A1 amendment adds Article 2 to House File 3790. These are the conforming changes. The language was worked on by a distinguished committee of real estate practitioners, including Professor Eileen Roberts of William Mitchell, Chuck Parsons, Chuck Hoyam, Mr. Smith, Tim Anderson of the Eggstar, Marty Hensel of Edina Realty, Rick Little, Larry Galeen from Anoka County, and the former Senator Chris Knock. It's been looked at by the Real Property Executive Council. They had no objections. Jennifer Carey, the co-legislative chair of the Real Property Section, has had no objections. The task force, the current task force, approved this at their meeting on February 20th, and so, members, we ask for your support of the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Representative Lesch, any additional testimony?
Yes, Michael Kniff. Mr. Michael Kniff, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. Mr. Kniff. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just add what Representative Lesh has said. This has been a 8-year project in terms of pilots to move us from where we have been with paper documents to make it possible to do electronic recording. This is the final stage in terms of trying to provide for a permanent piece of legislation so that we would no longer be dealing with pilots having to come back every 2 or 3 years to ask you not to allow this to sunset, but to make it a permanent piece of transaction, business transactions for real estate documents throughout the state of Minnesota. I think that's the most important piece that we get to that point. I think we're all pretty excited about it, and we are very appreciative of the Secretary of State's efforts over the last number of years in helping support it, as well as all of you in reading our reports and continuing to support the ability to move this type of technology forward in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Kniff. Representative Lesh, anybody else that you want to have us hear from?
My name is Joel Beckman. I'm the Director of Property Taxation and Records for Dakota County Homes, Caravan Hatchin. I just want to stress very much that this still creates a historical record that people can view. It's not just held in an electronic format. It renders itself into documentation that looks just like any other property document. The other thing I'd like to stress is throughout the 5+ years that we've been testing this and utilizing this technology, there hasn't been one instance of any security failure whatsoever. So property records are just as safe in the state of Minnesota when filed electronically as they are in the old paper world. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Are there any questions, concerns from members of the committee? Representative Vila Forrest.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. I'll direct my question to Mr. Black. Mr. Black, is this the bill, the real estate bill with the history that this body has spent so much time arbitrating? So that Representative Vandeveer had this, I think, once upon a time, and Secretary of State, is this that bill? I guess if you're a state government finance committee member and the like, you remember this bill.
Mr. Chairman and Representative De La Forest, this is that task force, yes, but there is peace in the valley.
Well,
Representative De La Forest,
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask them that we have the page get house photography because we'll need the Yalta style photo after this bill is done. Thank you. I don't know if it was Representative Lesh getting the bill or not, but holy smokes. I mean, Mr. Black and the rest know this bill has consumed hours and made hundreds, thousands of hours of time. So if this is the Peace in the Valley bill, I'll say no more about it except congratulations. It's finally done.
Any final words, Representative Lesh?
Well, I don't know if there's any testimony in opposition. I know Bob Tennyson was here. I don't think he's voting. He's fine, okay.
No other testimony, Mr. Chair. With that, Chair Atkins renews his motion on House File 3790, recommended a pass to the Committee on Local Government and Metro.
Mr. Chair, I think it needs to go to Government Operations. Because we're creating a commission.
Okay. Is that the original motion? Must have been. It was requested by local government. So, what is the author's?
Well, I think if it's requested by local government, it would go there. I think the anticipation is the next stop would be GovOp, so, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Well, it has to go to GovOp.
Okay. With that, Chair Atkins renews his motion that House File 3790 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to local government and Metropolitan Affairs. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Your bill passes.
Thank you all.
Representative Huntley? I understand you have some amendments as well. Maybe.
Nope.
I'll move that House File 3391 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance with a referral to Health and Human Services and Finance.
Second.
excuse me. Representative Huntley, can you present your bill, please? And then I understand there's some amendments that will be coming down the pike, and we can work on that.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 3391 is a health care reform bill that grew out of the Governor's Health Care Transformation Task Force, as well as the Health Care Access Commission, that both groups met during the, almost constantly during the summer and fall. And there are parts of this bill that are supported by business, parts that are supported by labor, parts that are supported by the health plan, but the upshot of both those groups was a proposal that we had to do cost containment in healthcare. We had to reduce spending in healthcare, and if we did that at the same time, we could move towards universal coverage. So that's what both those groups recommended. That's what's in this bill. I would certainly say that everything is controversial in this bill. When you try to change the system, people become uncomfortable with any significant change. What this bill does is focus on our current healthcare system, and for those that don't know, about 75% of the money we spend in healthcare is spent on people with chronic illnesses, and about 60% is spent on people with five different chronic illnesses. And I always like to quote Willie Sutton, who was asked, why do you rob banks, Willie? And he said, because that's where the money is. And if you want to save money in healthcare, you have to go where it's spent. And that is in these chronic diseases. We heard a lot of testimony from physicians and healthcare groups demonstrated that they could greatly reduce healthcare spending. The best one was the St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, but there was a similar study for Park Nicholas, where they took people with congestive heart failure, reduced the spending on them by 48%, and greatly improved their health. And they did that by keeping them out of the emergency room, out of the hospital. Unfortunately, they lost $1 million doing that because they couldn't get paid for what they did, which was hire a bunch of nurses to monitor these patients and keep track of them, make sure they were taking their meds, and so on. Both groups concluded we must change the payment system. We ought to reward providers that do what providers know they should do, and not punish them by causing them to lose money when they do that. The parts of this bill that relate to insurance are listed on the handout. There is a requirement that any employer that has three or more employees must offer a Section 125 plan for their employees. Cost of that is thought to be less than $1,000 for the employer to set it up, and he makes that much money back because he doesn't have to pay income tax he does not have to pay Social Security and Medicare payments on that part of that salary's reimbursement. The Section 125 is simply a way for an individual to get that's employed at, where he does not get health care, to get the tax advantages that the rest of us have with our health plan. So it allows them to pay for their premiums with tax-free dollars, or before tax dollars. On pages 32 to 38, the bill sets up what's called the State Health Insurance Exchange that passed out of this committee last year, and that is an initiative by the governor. Basically, it's a place where people, individuals, can purchase insurance either in the small employer market or in the individual market, and that this is an attempt to make it easier for companies and for their employees to purchase health care through these 125 plans. The exchange would also offer Minnesota Care, and if we ever get to the point where we're going to offer subsidies to make sure people have universal care, those subsidies would be funneled through this organization as well. Brokers would participate in these. They would get paid the same broker fee they get paid on products sold outside of the exchange, so there's no loss to them. On pages 40 to 45 and 48 to 50, we set up what's called a transformation commission, which sets up a study group to look at a standard benefit set, how we do the payment reform. It does a health technology assessment to look at new technology that comes into the healthcare industry to see if it's really cost effective. And it has a system, or will have a work group to decide how you measure quality or outcomes in the medical area. And this is important. This is a simplification. Right now, every health plan has their own quality standards that they set providers, that are set for providers. So each provider has to monitor things different from each health plan. What this would do is consolidate that, as we have done the uniform billing, so that all the insurance companies have the same billing. This says that all the insurance companies will have the same quality standards for the providers to follow. And let's see. The bill has goals for universal coverage, and we hope to reach, let's find the page here, I think it's 96% coverage. Right now we're at 93%. The intent is to go to, I think it's 94 by 2010, but I'm facing the exact year for that. In addition to that, both these groups, particularly the governor's group, looked at cost effectiveness of various things we could do. And if you look at the slope of healthcare spending, we're about $30 billion a year in Minnesota today, and by 2010, it'll be about $42 billion. What this proposal attempts to do is cut that slope down so that we can save 20% by 2011. And I don't think we'll do it by 2011, but by 2015 we should have 20% savings. So that means everybody's insurance premiums would be 20% less than they would be if we do nothing. And there'll be a lot of talk here today saying do nothing. But I think we need to move ahead with this. And we're going to pay for the universal coverage by a fee or a withhold on those, that reduction, but the reduction in prices has to be there or we won't take any money to subsidize people's health insurance. Again, many of the features in this bill are supported by the governor, certainly not all of them, and this bill is still a work in progress. It will change in this committee. It will change when it gets to my committee, and it will certainly change in the conference committee. But my goal is to get the bill that the governor will sign that will get us on the way to reducing healthcare spending by 20% and start the steps towards comprehensive, affordable healthcare for every Minnesotan.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. I was mistaken earlier when I mentioned that we had amendments. There are no amendments that I'm aware of at this point. Also, hopefully, everybody has an opportunity to look in their packets or on the table here. We have a letter from the Minnesota Business Partnership. It's written by Beth Hartwig, and it's some written testimony that pertains to the bill that's before us today. So, are you ready to...
That was my presentation, Mr. Chair, and I think there are people signed up to testify.
Okay. We have quite a list, and we're going to stick to the list. You know, to start with here, Aaron Sexton. Please state your name for the record, and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Erin Sexton. I'm the Director of Healthcare Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Excuse me. We are far from being in the do-nothing camp on healthcare reform. We are very pleased that House File 3391 takes significant steps toward reforming our health care system. And we're very hopeful that these steps will reduce the cost and improve the quality of our system, creating a much better value equation for the purchasers and users of the healthcare system. However, we do oppose a few provisions that are relevant to this committee. We are supportive of the concept of the health insurance exchange. We believe that the proposed exchange will provide a mechanism for employers to help their employees obtain coverage in the private market by allowing them to purchase individual health insurance using pre-tax dollars. Saying that, we oppose mandating employers to establish Section 125 plans in Article 4, Section 8. If the health insurance exchange provides the benefits that many hope it will, employers will establish Section 125 voluntarily. There are administrative costs for establishing and administering these plans, and each employer should be able to make the decision on what makes the most sense for their company and their employees. In addition, the exchange has the power to assess fees on premiums of small employers or small employee plans and individual plans, which will add to the cost of premiums, and that's in Article 4, Section 7. We are also opposed to the health savings recapture assessment established in Article 4, Section 13. This essentially equates to an additional premium tax on those who are purchasing health insurance in the private market, and coupled with the assessment allowed to fund the health insurance exchange, this bill will be adding additional taxes and fees on top of the many we already have. Adding up the current taxes that we have on the fully insured market, those that apply to all employers, and these new ones, it could be upwards of 11% on premiums for those small and medium employers in the fully insured market. And just because the overall system may achieve savings does not mean that a small business will see a premium reduction. If an employer with 20 employees has a relatively good year health-wise, they may see a reduction in the rate of increase. But if that employer has two employees, one with cancer, and an employee who has a baby that year, they will likely see a significant increase in their premiums and the additional increase of the health savings assessment driving their premiums even higher. Also, if challenged under ERISA, this has the potential to fall solely on the fully insured market, which is made up, as you know, of mainly small and medium-sized employers. So addressing the cost of health care is a huge priority for our members. And although there are many pieces of this bill that we do support and like, we are hopeful that we can accomplish this without adding additional taxes and fees onto those, especially the small, medium-sized employers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sexton. Any questions for Ms. Sexton or Representative DeLaForest?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is that how you're going to handle it? Will this question each witness, or do you want to take all the testimony and then move to committee discussion?
I was thinking testimony first, but if you have a, I don't want.
Oh, go ahead. I just had a brief
thank
question,
you,
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
If that's Ms. Sexton, as the bill is written now, obviously your organization is opposed. I just want to make it clear. Do you believe that at least for the majority of employers that it will actually raise their costs as opposed to reducing them?
Mr. Chair, Representative DeLaForest, I think the unfortunate part of this bill is that's very hard to say, and that's what makes us very nervous. We do think a lot of the reforms have the potential to reduce costs, but by adding these additional fees and taxes, I think that becomes very unclear and has a real potential to drive costs up for many, especially the small and medium-sized employers in the fully insured market.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sexton, you talked a little bit about the small company that has the employees, and one has cancer and one has a pregnancy, and it pushes their bills up. Do we have any, is there any protection in this for any kind of caps on it? Or this small company, has that happened 2 years, 3 years in a row? What happens to that company?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simpson, it's my understanding that the band that we have, small employer premiums, are capped at a 25% increase. And I'm sure there's someone from the health plans or Representative Huntley that can correct me if I'm wrong there. But the assessments that are in here, the recapture assessment is capped at 4%. But that's on top of the 2% that's paid for MSA, the 1% to 2% for premium tax, the 0.5% for the MA surcharge, the 2% provider tax. And now the two new fees and assessments will be up to 6 different health care taxes on premiums.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you. I'll wait for Representative Huntley to answer that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It looks like we have perhaps two people together, Mr. Tyler and Ms. Brazy. Brace? Sorry. Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm from Citizens Council on Healthcare. And we would just like to draw your attention to some of the sections of the bill that are of concern to us, having to do with the insurance provisions. In particular, our concern is the health insurance exchange, which we really believe is going to set up a brand new expensive bureaucracy, which is going sort of a super agency for what will happen to health care and health insurance in the state of Minnesota. If you look at the end of the Health Commission, Health Transformation Commission section, you will see, and unfortunately I can't find right where that is, but what you will see is that it says that after the Health Commission goes away in like 3 years, then all the duties of the Health Transformation Commission will be transferred to the Health Insurance Exchange, which of course means that the Health Insurance Exchange is the one that gets to decide perhaps what kind of benefits we'll have, what kind of insurance policy we'll be able to get, and the whole payment reform initiative, the quality and efficiency measurements. And I think it's important to point out to this committee that there's nothing in the bill that defines quality and efficiency. And when we look at bills, we try to see that what is in there an average person could understand, so that there is actually a rule of law upon which doctors and patients can base what they're doing and base their actions. But physicians will be paid according to what somebody else determines as quality and efficiency. So these kind of decisions will be run essentially by the Health Insurance Exchange. The exchange will also have to be paid for, and it's going to be an assessment that we don't know what that amount of assessment is going to be. That's going to increase the cost of your insurance premium. And in addition to that, it will have a board of governors, and that board of governors are unappointed, and they are appointed. They're unelected, which means that they are essentially an entity unto themselves. There's not even any rulemaking authority for their decisions about what will happen to our insurance, what kind of premiums will be placed on our insurance policies. And we think that the legislature should understand that what you're creating through this bill, or what this bill would create, is an entity that will not really have all the public accountability and will be a bureaucracy that will add additional cost regulation and limits on access to health care and insurance choices. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Mr. Tyler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I would like to echo Ms. Sexton's concern about or mandating or requiring the Section 125 plans as part of the integral part of this health insurance exchange. On page 38, Section 8, in particular, lines 38.18 down, each employer that has three or more current employees shall establish a Section 125 plan to either allow its employees to purchase individual health market coverage or allow its employees to pay the employee's premium, share premiums with employer-based health plan with pre-tax dollars. That's all well and good. I just wanted to point out a couple of things. First of all, the Section 125 plan is universally available right now, has been since 1954, as part of an integral part of the Internal Revenue Code. This is nothing new. The other part of this is that where applicable, the Section 125, I would say, is probably near universal already, but it is not universally applicable. There are discrimination tests that an employer must pass in order to properly implement a Section 125, particularly for highly compensated employees versus non-highly compensated employees. And if their plan does not pass muster with the discrimination testing, it is a non-qualified plan. So it sets up the small employer for a payroll tax audit that could potentially create a situation where an employer is attempting to comply with the mandate but is out of compliance. So it really doesn't apply to them, and it's not applicable to them. So there is an inherent conflict with that between the Internal Revenue Code discrimination tests that are required to make these plans applicable and the potential mandate. So making it available is one thing, but mandating it is quite another. Also on page 39, subdivision 5, line 39.22 and then 39.28,
of particular concern is the guaranteed issue requirement for any employee purchasing an individual plan through the health insurance exchange and the 125 plan. That is a particular concern because the guaranteed issue, individuals who purchase an individual market health plan through a 125 plan may purchase coverage on a guaranteed issue basis during an annual open enrollment period that coincides with the annual open enrollment period for the employer's 125 plan. This may seem very nice as a nice way of getting people insured that are presently uninsured, but wherever in this country where this has been tried, where guaranteed issue individual policies has been tried, the state of New York in particular, the insurance premiums have shot through the roof for individual policies. Now, this is a very sensitive market area, and right now I would point out that right now the state of Minnesota has among the most competitive individual policy premiums in the country. We have a little different situation of guaranteed issue. Individual applies for standard health insurance. If they are declined or rated with that, they may apply to the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association that is funded, as Ms. Sexton mentioned, through a 2% premium tax already. That works beautifully. That protects the individual marketplace on a medically underwritten basis with keep the premiums low. We have the majority that are able to purchase coverage that way, and to attack on small employer plans, the MCHA, or Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, not Minnesota Care, but the MCHA, administered by Medica, allows for an affordable purchase on a guaranteed issue basis. So it separates the adverse risk from the positive risk, allowing the majority to have very, very affordable premiums. That's a brilliant approach that absolutely works very, very well in this marketplace, contrasted with guaranteed issue states that have absolute premiums that are unaffordable for the general populace, and at the heart of those problems are the guarantee issues. So the intention is to bring premiums down, but the guarantee issue, I feel, if the state of New York and other states that have tried it, it will backfire. It will absolutely backfire. And it is well documented nationally that this is the case. The other aspect of this overall government bureaucracy process, or establishing this new government bureaucracy, I'd like to just create a little analogy, if I could, with an overloaded semi-truck that gets stuck under a bridge. It's too full, it's too big, it's too fat, it's too heavy to get underneath the bridge. So a government bureaucracy is created to decide whether or not you should dismantle the bridge to allow the truck to get through, to get underneath the bridge. Or perhaps we should establish a bureaucracy to dismantle the truck to get it underneath the bridge. Or perhaps, as a bystander might observe, well, why don't we just let a little bit of air out of the tires and back the truck out from underneath the bridge? And this employer survey right here shows what employers feel about the exchange. 93% are opposed of over 500 employers that were surveyed here. So this is actually, they do not want additional premium taxes. Affordability is their issue. This group is asking for a little air to be let out of the tires, not to continue to pump the tires up with more mandates, more expenses, more premium taxes. So I would really encourage in your deliberations, please do no harm. We have a very, very effective system for purchasing individual insurance. We have a very, very affordable system for buying individual insurance. In Minnesota, over 93% are insured in one way or the other in Minnesota. That's the best in the country. We believe that this legislation would really, because of guarantee issues and the whole requirement for the 125, would actually, plus the taxes that would be imposed to fund it, would actually help destroy that scenario rather than improve it.
Thank you, Mr. Tyler and Ms. Brace. Sorry if I'm saying your name wrong. Any questions for these folks? We're kind of, I think we'll go with that direction. Representative Dela Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for Mr. Tyler regarding the Section 125 plan requirement. It sounded from your testimony as if there's an inherent conflict between the mandates of this bill and the Internal Revenue Code. Apparently there's a test for qualifying the plan, and you're suggesting that perhaps there may be employers under this bill who would be required to offer a Section 125 plan, yet would be non-qualified per the Internal Revenue Code. Did I hear that correctly? And the reason why I ask is I look at the last sentence beginning on line 23. It says, an employer that has no employees who are eligible to participate is exempt. So I'm assuming then that the qualified test isn't based necessarily on employees. Could you flesh that out for me a little bit more? Because I'm concerned here with this potential inherent conflict. And more than that, tell me what happens then. Suppose this bill becomes law and we still have the IRC test for qualification for Section 125. What's the employer to do?
Mr. Tyler.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Thanks for the question. An employer does not have employees and they are exempt because they don't have employees. is the way I read that provision of the bill. And to answer your question, absolutely, if an employer does not pass a discrimination test and incurs a payroll audit, what they incur taxes, fines, and penalties for both the employer and the employees as far as back taxes that are owed on the premiums paid to the plan if it does not qualify. And so there is some degree of due diligence here to discern whether or not a 125 fine really fits the employer or not. You know, that's on top of the additional tax reporting that goes on as far as maintaining compliance and so on. So it doesn't fit everybody, unfortunately. And we wish it could, but it doesn't.
Representative Zia LaForce. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we have a lot of witnesses to hear from. The hour's getting late, but I'd like to hear from Representative Huntley at some point where, we got the three employees and things like that, because it sounds like there's a big incongruence here between the Internal Revenue Code requirements for the non-discrimination test and what is mandated in the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, yes, it could potentially put an employer in between trying to adhere to the mandate at the state level and being not in compliance at the federal level.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tyler. Ms. Thompson?
No.
I think what we'll do is we'll go through the testimony maybe a little faster, and then we'll have questions at the end here. And so, Ms. Thompson, if you could... It is getting a little late, and we have actually quite a few more bills on the agenda, so if you can help us out, sometimes short is better.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today on this bill, House File 3391. My name is Kim Thompson. I am a member of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters Legislative Council Committee. I am also an independent agent in the business 26 years. I own a small business. I am one of those small companies that will be damaged by the 125 regulations in this bill, by the way. Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters has 450 members that deal in health insurance. They consist of agents, brokers, consultants, and insurance carriers and various other entities that deal in the health industry. We work with hundreds of thousands of Minnesota taxpayers every day. Those are your constituents we're working with. As I said, I'm here to testify in opposition primarily to two parts of this bill. The first one being the exchange and the second one being the revenue recovery portion of the bill. The first item is with regard to the exchange and the services that the exchange proposes to offer. Every item that they propose to offer is currently available right now in the market through independent agents and brokers who have been doing this for years and years very cost effectively. The second, on the revenue recovery proposal, to capture the savings of the dollars that really don't exist, but we're going to capture them anyway, give them to the state, and then ask for the state to dole them out, it just makes no sense. In reading the House File 3391, we noted that the stated goal of this proposed legislation is to increase the affordability and access of health care and health insurance for Minnesotans. As we reviewed the bill, the number of positive items that were aligned in the bill we agree with are currently being taken care of out in the private market right now by insurance carriers and insurance agents, and we applaud their efforts and their recognition of those items. However, we also note that if the goal was to increase affordability under this bill, that we should identify where in this bill the affordability factor comes into play. And we went through the bill, we found very few places where there was actually cost-effective pieces of the bill. What we did find is over 28 items of additional new costs that would be incurred in one way or another on the taxpayers in Minnesota. Based on the Minnesota Department of Health and FDA's 2006 report, the health coverage in Minnesota, it states that among those who fail to enroll in plans or eligible to enroll in right now, in the private market, specifically in group insurance, that shows the lowest percentage of uninsured individuals, which illustrates the current system does work effectively in the private market currently. Government programs is where we find the highest number of individuals who are eligible for plans who do not enroll in those programs. Many of those who are eligible for government health care plans struggle to understand and make the right decision currently. They're processed right now through all kinds of electronic means, either on the computer, either through communication on a telephone, through voicemail, a variety of different directions they can go. What they don't have is they don't have a person that they can sit down with like people in the individual market currently do, like people in the group market currently do. They don't have a professional who can sit down with them and say, here are all of your options. Here's what this means, not in legalese, but here's what this means in real everyday terms to you for this plan design. And here are the costs and how you can pay for them. That's the piece that those folks don't have right now, and why they're struggling, I think, with the government program. Thus, introducing the exchange to do work in the private market, I don't see how that will affect the majority of the currently uninsured individuals in the state of Minnesota. You're not putting it in place in the one area where it's most needed, which is with relationship to the government program.
Thank you.
Not quite through. I'm trying to talk as fast as I can.
Okay. I thought you were done. I'm sorry.
I just took a breath. I also wanted to note that Cal Ludeman recently noted that there are plans to fold MCHA into the exchange, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. It's currently running at a $100 million deficit. We would question how you, when you fold this population into the exchange, add community rating provisions with rate banding and guaranteed issue, how that will help to lower the cost for anybody. In fact, the price of individual policies will skyrocket, and the net result will have the youngest and healthiest populations in Minnesota dropping out of health plans, creating an even greater number of uninsured in our state. I wanted to just run through quickly some of the cost items, not all 28 of them, but some of the cost items that are currently connected to the exchange. We have the additional cost of creating, operating, publicity, IT expenses, which will in one way or another hit the taxpayer. We have structure of the exchange is questionable. We're not sure from the bill whether it's tax exempt, whether it's going to be an association, a nonprofit, and one, whichever one of those it chooses, once it complies with that, then the statutes that apply that will create additional costs. The exchange requires an individual to rank health plans on their own, which means that they have to be smart enough on insurance to take those plans and rank them. What will happen is they'll look at them, they won't understand it, they'll choose the least costly health plan that they can find, and when their claims aren't paid, they won't understand why. And when they don't understand why, the legal remedy that they'll have is to go to the commissioner for any complaints. So the cost to assist, another item which you've already heard about is the cost to assist employers with 125 implementation, which they're requiring under the bill. As I said, I'm a small employer. I have 3 employees. The cost for me to implement a 125 plan is about $1,200 a year. I, as a sole proprietor, am not even eligible for this plan as our S Corporation partners and owners. So I would not even be eligible for a plan I'm forced to implement. My employees, the cost savings on 3 employees for the premium that we pay is, number one, going to be about $300, so not anywhere near the $1,000 that it would cost me to implement it. And number two, I pay 100% of the premium for my employees. They don't need a Section 125 plan. So those are a couple of the items. Licensed agents and brokers work with insured now.
I think that's really fair. We have about 5 more folks that want to testify.
I understand. I've waited a long time.
Please
to get
stick around and we'll stand for questions maybe later.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Allen? Okay, well, you can announce your name for the record. And
thank you, Representative.
Again, I'm just going to repeat myself. Please.
I will keep it brief. I appreciate your time, Representative. My name is Steve Elon. I'm from Sartell, Minnesota. I am a private. I have a private practice for insurance. I do know that there are numerous insurance professionals here today that have sat here for quite a few hours in order to hear this bill. I will make it as brief as possible, as John Tyler had testified to. I liked his analogy of the overloaded truck trying to get underneath the bridge, and let's let some air out of the tires. I have testified in front of the Senate last week, talked with our Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, and I think what we need to do is take a step back and look at, first of all, what is the exchange going to try and solve? All I hear is that the exchange, by implementing cafeteria plans to employers and individuals to be able to purchase their insurance on a pre-tax basis, is what really fundamentally you want the exchange for.
instead of creating the bureaucracy of the exchange and saying, well, we're going to lift the mandates, we aren't mandating this, we aren't requiring it, most likely that's what's going to happen down the road. And it's also going to add costs to the taxpayers and the individuals that are hurting in the insurance industry right now, or the individuals that get their health insurance. My proposal would be, let's give people the tax credits. We can keep the current Section 125 cafeteria flex plans in place. They have their merits for certain employers, certain people, as far as being able to pre-tax any of their out-of-pocket medical, dental, or vision expenses, as well as daycare and those types of things. But across the board, just pass the legislation federally and in the state of Minnesota that anyone that carries insurance can just get a tax credit or a deduction on their taxes. I mean, it's so simple, instead of trying to create this complicated mess. My specialty is working with large employers. I have seen in the market, by taking employers whose premiums have gotten so catastrophically high that the employers are mandated in the state of Minnesota to pay at least 50% of the insurance costs on their employees. They don't have to pay anything for the dependents. The ones that are hurting in this state of Minnesota are the families that are struggling to pay those insurance costs. Or if they end up leaving that employer, and then what are they faced with? They're faced with the COBRA premiums, trying to come up to pay for those COBRA premiums. I have a system that's better, and I've been using it. I have employers that have said, you know what, we're getting rid of our group insurance. We're going to have individual insurance. I do run cafeteria plans through the private market for those people to allow the pre-taxability, because those are the tools that are available to us now. But I have seen a significant decrease in the amount of uninsured, because now the families can afford to get the coverage, get individual high deductible plans coincided with health savings accounts or health reimbursement arrangements, HRAs. And the answer is so simple, and it also ties the individual back into the equation. Anytime you let people's pocketbooks be into that equation, they're going to be making good consumer-driven choices. So it reduces the cost of our medical premiums and the renewals on the insurance premiums. We're seeing renewal increases on Blue Cross, Medicare, Preferred One, and Health Partners on those high deductible plans of single digits, if you look over it over the last 5 years, as well as the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Plan. So to keep intact what we have, which is a very good system, we have amongst the lowest uninsured in the country in this state, let's allow the availability for just pre-taxability of the insurance premiums, keep intact the good systems that we have, let's not tear those down and destroy it, and allow, you know, now individuals will have portability. So if they have individual health insurance coverages, if they leave their employer, they don't have to worry about, well, let's see, now do I go into a different 125 plan? What do I do? It's portable. I mean, it's there. They own it. They have it for life once they have it. In the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, that's just supported by the 2% tax and also by our carriers in Minnesota and all the insured to help sustain that pool. We have seen, I think this last year on the Minnesota Comprehensive Health, it was like a 2% or a 1% rate increase. That's for our unhealthy population in this state. The system works, and that's how insurance works. The system works, and that's how insurance works. It's a matter of managing risk. And by properly putting people into the managed risk pools, the MSHA or standard risk pools, let's not ruin that by trying to do guaranteed issue and drive our costs way up. I have seen it work, and the average savings to my employer group are 35 to 50%. I also have people that they had higher out-of-pocket medical costs before under their group plans, where now it's cut down to almost half. So I've seen it work, it does work, and I know it works. So that's what I do every day, and that's my passion. So I'm sorry if I appear that I'm a little over-passionate about this, but that's my job as an agent, is to try and help people and give them the tools in their tool belt to make the right choices. So I think instead of an exchange and creating this big bureaucracy that we have to somehow fund, why don't we just make the simple solution? Just allow people, if they have insurance premiums, to do it pre-tax without having to set up the premium-only portion of a cafeteria plan or a full cafeteria plan that all costs money to run. I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you, sir. Please stick around for questions, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Mr. Nighteen? Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Name is Eric Newton. Here today as both a citizen as well as a representative of a firm that works with thousands of employers in the state of Minnesota regarding their benefits and benefits consulting. I, in a matter of keeping this brief, I will not reiterate many of the good points that were already made today. We'll keep your eye focused on these three things. First, the small businesses in Minnesota have enough challenges, especially coming down the road. We need to keep their costs down as much as possible. The present system works. There are issues. Parts of this bill address some of those issues, but the exchange in particular will increase costs to employers, make employers uncompetitive in Minnesota, and long-term, make it hard to do business here. Number two, Section 125 plans have been around for 55 years. They are a great tool. They are widely used presently. We represent several thousand companies in the state of Minnesota, and I can't guarantee you that every one of them has a Section 125 plan, but I would put it at over 99% of them have one. Building a plan that mandates these programs makes it hard for employers that don't need one for various reasons. Now they have to run a plan, have to run a bureaucratic program because they are mandated to, rather than making a business decision on if they need a program, if it fits, if it's good to help them attract and retain quality employees. Number three, I would lastly bring up, I know recently the survey was handed around by Mr. Tyler. I'd also keep you guys focused on the recent focus group report that was done by the Minnesota Department of Health. Employers spoke through this. You guys should have access to this. If not, I can get you copies of this. It was very loud and clear in these focus groups that employers in Minnesota do not want the exchange. They do not see this as a competitive advantage. They see it as a problem, going to drive up the cost, and they were very vocal in the focus groups. This was just done this past December, so it's very recent information. They do not want the exchange. They see it as a problem to do business in Minnesota. That's it.
Thank you very much, sir. Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And since we're not the health care committee, thank God, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, we probably don't have that study available to us. So if you wouldn't mind writing the chair or one of the pages so we can get copies, I'd appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
Very much so. Certainly.
Thank you very much, sir. And any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, all these names, I'm just really going to butcher them all, I guess. Mr. Esseline? Esselison? Something. Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, sir. Sorry. Oh,
did
man.
You say you did have...
You know, we're all getting a little tired, but you're doing good.
I understand.
That
Tom,
guy was fantastic.
Tom Esseline. Did you have a copy or did you get a copy of the Department of Health bill? Okay.
They're going to make copies and pass it out to all members. Go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Everything's been covered pretty much that I was going to talk about, but I just want to tell you a little bit about myself, Mr. Chairman and committee. I've been in the health insurance business for 30 years, 20 years for working for health insurance companies, the last few years for one of the largest HMOs. I left that industry to become an independent agent. I own a small firm of 8 employees. And one of the greatest experiences I learned on my first board was somebody stood up and criticized, and he was reprimanded by someone that said, "Don't criticize unless you have a solution." And I think I do have some solutions here for this bill. The first one is that I don't think there's anyone more passionate than the 4,000 agents in the state that sell health insurance. We've looked at the Department of Health study that showed the biggest growth in uninsured came from the public sector from 2001 to 2004. It grew to over 200,000 from 120. The private sector grew by substantially less than that. And it has proof that independent agents and health agents are out there talking to their clients. Certainly, there's no perfect solution. I know that Representative Huntley wants to get across and take care of those that are in need, but so do we. And one of the things that's been an issue for us is that we, as agents, are handicapped in not being able to help the public sector with health care. And I recommend that we be allowed to help them and
and do that in an official way because we know and understand what they do. I want to quickly just read for you, very, very quickly, but in trying to help, as you know, we don't get paid to help people in the public sector in Minnesota Care, somebody's uninsured, but I want to give you an example of a client of mine from Dakota County that got into a very difficult situation and had to go on Minnesota Care. I want to read his letter. It says, by program regulation, financial workers are allowed time to process your application. It may take 45 to 60 days to process your health care application. Now, here's an important point. Calling our agency will only delay our ability to process your application. If you call, we will not have any information to give you until you receive a notice from your worker. The financial worker will let you know if you need to provide further information. You'll be notified in writing if you qualify for any of the health care programs. That's not what we do. What we do is talk to people. We talk to hundreds of them. I manage $300 million block of business for this particular health maintenance organization and thousands of employees, and that's what we do. My second comment, briefly, would just be to suggest that there's no need for small group in the exchange. There's no need for it to be a part of it. The exchange we'd like to see not exist, but that is certainly something that is being handled very efficiently. And to touch on John, I'm not going to go into details, but the guarantee issue I saw firsthand working 20 years for health carriers, that when you do something on a guarantee issue, it takes the balance and it sways it tremendously. It doesn't necessarily accomplish the uninsured, but it skews up prices. Now, what I think that we need to do is look at including an alternative of health savings accounts. I've had 7 heart surgeries. I've had my open heart valve surgery. Spent over $500,000 in health care. So when I talk to clients, thank you. So when I talk to clients, I understand, and I would disagree with him that the healthcare system is broken. It's not broken. We every one of us around the table, if we needed heart surgery, we can get it. I've had 3 defibrillators. I have my 3rd one from Medtronic at $50,000 a pop. Yes, those that need the care spend a lot of money, but that's the country we live in, providing great health care to 93% of the people. Even Hawaii, with a mandated health program, they got an exemption because they passed a law before ERISA was passed in 1974. They have a higher uninsured rate than we do. So just to try and be brief here and wrap up, the other thing we do is we have a great tool that we've talked about already, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, to put people in when they don't have an opt-out, they don't have pre-existing conditions, we can put them in that plan and be taken care of. So I'm recommending that you let agents do their job. Get out there and help cover the uninsured. Get the uninsured coverage that they need and talk to them intelligently and not force them to do things online or get letters, form letters back, but take care of them. The last thing I would just say is it's a privilege to be here. I have never been involved in the process before and believe in it greatly, but appreciate all of you listening and thank you for allowing us to speak and talk against the exchange. So thank you.
Thank you for coming down here. Thank you for your testimony. And stick around. We might have some questions for you, sir. Mr. Heidorn?
Very good. I got it right.
Phew. 1 out of 10.
Must be German. That's not a German name. Thank you. My name is John Heidorn. I have been a licensed insurance professional for the past 25 years in Minnesota, specializing in health care plans for primarily employer groups, but also for individuals and retirees. I'm primarily against the exchange portion of the bill for the following reasons. The exchange itself has some stated goals, which are greater access, choice, portability, and affordability. The exchange, as it's written, is completely redundant on services that exist in the private marketplace today. It's not going to provide the same amount of plans. They're going to winnow the plans down and only offer a few, not to confuse people, so it's not certainly going to increase the choice of options that are available. It also says that it's going to increase access. Well, here's how healthcare is accessed today. You have, as Mr. Asleason said, 4,000 professional health insurance agents that spend all day long counseling, administering, and implementing, and managing and servicing those various health plans, whether they're for individuals or groups, employer groups. The second thing is that in the event that someone still wanted to use the internet, you have dozens of mature websites for analysis that already exist today. We shouldn't be spending government money and spending and making a bureaucracy for services that currently exist in the private marketplace. It's a duplication and a redundancy. When you talk about the exchange itself, you're going to be buying the same Medica products and Blue Cross products that are existing today. You're also going to continue to buy them through the insurance professionals and counselors that exist today. None of that's changed, except the exchange is going to have to hire a third-party administrator to put a billing system together and to generate revenue to pay for themselves. So there is no way that I can determine that this isn't going to increase the expense to those people either buying individual plans or group insurance plans. I do understand that there is some motivation to do some kind of health reform. The governor is behind the bill to some degree, and I understand that. I'm not sure if he's behind the exchange portion, which I have an issue for. In the event you do continue to move forward with this particular bill or the exchange portion of it, I would at least request the following potential amendment. In line 37.34, relating to the insurance producer's segment, where it says that a person can go ahead and use any licensed insurance producer or professional to buy their individual plan, I do notice that the exchange itself is still offering group insurance products through it. If it moves forward, I would ask that you amend that piece to also have the insurance producer involved in the group insurance segment and not just limit it. The employers themselves rely on us day in and day out to counsel them and assist them, and they're going to continue to need to use us because the exchange itself isn't really going to provide an avenue, as Tom so eloquently stated from the letter from the government agency, don't call us, you're going to be lost. That's all I had. I appreciate and I'll reiterate Tom's comments that I do appreciate. I haven't been involved in legislative issues before. This one's near and dear to my heart, and I appreciate the chance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heidorn. We've got two other people that asked to be heard this evening, Ms. Broner and Mr. Nagel. If they would both come up at this point, I'd appreciate it. This is where I make my little Wednesday morning speech, which is if folks have emphasized your points already, obviously there's a lot of nice people, most of whom don't work here, that need to be up and working early in the morning tomorrow. So if you want to add any points that haven't been made, we'd appreciate it. Welcome, Ms. Broner.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much. My name is Julie Bruner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The Council of Health Plans is the trade association for the 8 nonprofit HMOs in Minnesota. I want you to know, Mr. Chairman, that I have deleted about 3/4 of my testimony in the last 20 minutes, so I'll try to be very brief in my comments. First of all, I want to start by thanking Representative Huntley for his work over the last year to move health care reform forward. This is a very complex issue. He's shown important leadership on this issue, and we are pleased with many components in this bill. That said, there are a couple of areas that I want to highlight as of concern to the health plans. But I do want you to know that there are aspects of the bill in terms of public health expansion, expansion of eligibility for individuals, which we think are very important. A provision in the bill that we have great concerns about is the savings offset assessment. You've heard a little bit about that. In reality, we believe the savings offset assessment is a tax on health care premiums. This tax will increase the cost of premiums for small businesses and individuals. And you've heard this from other folks tonight. We expect that there would potentially be a ERISA challenge that would be upheld by the court related to the savings offset assessment. It can't, the way it's written, it can only apply to the fully insured market, and right now the fully insured market is only 27% of the insurance market in Minnesota. We understand and support the goals that that Representative Huntley is working to achieve: coverage for all Minnesotans, reducing the cost of care, and improving quality. But the tax on small employers and individuals isn't a fair way to reach these goals. Our view of this assessment in Maine suggests that it has many problems and has not had the impact of expanding coverage in the way that it was originally designed. We're also concerned about the 125 plan provisions in the bill related to the insurance exchange, and I think you've heard a lot of testimony about that, and I would second or third those comments. We also have some general questions about the overall value that the insurance exchange brings to Minnesotans. It's not clear to us what problems the exchange is actually going to solve. As I said, we support many parts of this bill, and we also realize that it is a work in progress and look forward to working with Representative Huntley as the bill moves forward. Thank you,
Ms. Bruner. Mr. Nagel?
Well, thank you for giving me a few minutes, and Mr. Chair and fellow representatives. The good news about being last is that pretty much everything's been said.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. We appreciate your comments. Is there anyone else
today? I guess I opened that door, didn't I?
I just made you Mr. Bruner.
I asked for that. You're right. You know, I just really affirm what these other people have been saying. I am against the exchange. I am an agent in Dasco, Minnesota, and I have an agency, and we service literally hundreds of clients, and both individual and small and large business. The employers we talk to are against the exchange, and you know, I do feel that many of the things that the exchange is looking at trying to do has already been done. You're just creating another level of bureaucracy. I would really encourage you not to pass this. You know, in closing comments, you know, one of the things that concerns me, I visited today with Blue Cross Blue Shield and Health Partners and their executives, and they're saying, you know, you're looking for a new job because we don't know how much longer agents are going to be around. And I would tell you this, and that is, we bring a level of service to our clients. If you can think of yourself, you know, you do all this. It amazes me you can do this every day. But, you know, we all have our level of expertise. And for many people, healthcare isn't one of them. That's what I do, is I try and sift through and help clients make right choices. I think we bring a lot of added value to our clients in education, as well as making good choices in their healthcare. I just really encourage you not to pass this exchange, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Nagel. We appreciate your time. Frankly, that goes for everybody that was kind enough to come in from apparently all corners of the state, including the most important corner of Daffel. we appreciate your patience with us. In visiting, frankly, with Representative Huntley earlier today, I do know that he considers it a work in progress, and he's continuing to work on it. He's very well aware. Probably I don't need to put words in his mouth, but he's aware of the exchange issue, and I know that he's very cognizant of the concerns, but I think it was nice to give voice to those concerns. Quite bluntly, folks, my expectation is that this bill will continue to progress through our committee and continue to be worked on. Ms. Bruner said it best when she referenced it as work in progress, but I think it helped a lot to hear those comments, particularly for the chief author and the members of this committee that deals with commerce issues. So that as it moves forward, we can hopefully address as many of those issues that have been raised as we possibly can. With that, I should also ask, is there anyone else? Those were the folks that were on our list, but that doesn't mean that we're not happy to hear from anybody else if any concerns that have not been raised. Otherwise, I'll look for questions or comments that members of the committee may have. Representative Simpson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, as a small business person, this you know, kind of perks your ears, of course, and we all are looking for trying to reduce costs and trying to provide insurance. And Representative Huntley, I think you indicated earlier that we have about 93-94% of our people insured, and you'd like to get it up to 96. I think that's yes. Kind of the number you said. And I found it interesting, the sheet that was handed out on this statewide survey. Right now, 94% of the people are offered group insurance through full-time employees.
through our business communities. I thought that was kind of interesting. And then I guess my next take would be with this insurance exchange, could you give us some justification? I mean, we just heard some compelling testimony from a lot of people here that are really involved in insurance agencies, the insurance business. I'm a grocer. I don't know much about insurance. I just know that I pay a lot of premiums every month for my health insurance for my staff. And I'm concerned about when I have professionals come up here and testify and tell me all these things that I've just heard, why are we going down this exchange with it, well, down this avenue with this insurance exchange? And I'd like to hear your take on it.
Representative Hunley.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, again, the exchange was passed out of this committee last year. It's the governor's proposal, not mine. The Transformation Task Force had business labor people involved, including Tom Forsyth, who was the chamber president when it started. He supports this. And so I think the participation in the exchange is not required. If a company buys insurance through the exchange, they will still use a broker, like the current system. So I don't see where brokers are going to lose anything with this.
Representative Simpson, anything further?
Well, I guess. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm concerned about the comments made. What are we going to eliminate a workforce that's out there? And you're indicating that that's not a reality. So how is it that there's a disconnect between what I'm hearing from these insurance agents and what you're trying to tell me? And
I think there's a difference in this year's, Mr. Chair and Representative Simpson. There's a difference between this bill and what was out last year.
Okay.
I think last year was a mandatory.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Simpson. Also, I wanted to point out there were a couple of folks that said they had recommended or suggestions or possible fixes. Representative Huntley, I know you'd be open to getting that language from them as well. I think it was either Mr. Aislesen, if I remember right, that said you don't come if you don't have a solution proposed, and I'd suggest that he be in touch with you and with the governor as well, because it's been a keen something the governor's been keenly interested in for the last year and a half. Are there other questions, comments from members? Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm with Representative Simpson. I don't own a grocery store, but I don't understand that much about insurance either, especially when it comes to some of the proposals from a broad sense. Some of the savings that we're looking or we're asking for some of these folks to provide would be rewarded with a higher tax, if I'm reading this right, and that, you know, dealing with my little kids, if they do something good, I give them a reward. I don't, you know, punish them with a timeout. And I'm kind of trying to figure that out in my mind. Again, I'm not a healthcare expert. Thank God I'm not on the committee. No offense, but
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the intent of this withhold is, again, I have the curve up here. If we don't get the savings, you know, the two lines are together, everything we tried didn't work, then there will be no withhold on the insurance company, so nobody will pay anything, and we won't have any money to subsidize people to get into the insurance market. So we believe, certainly the people in the business community that were on this task force believe that we will generate significant savings in the healthcare dollar. What we want to do is take a small portion of those savings and use it to subsidize people in their health care premiums if they can't afford their premiums. But the big bulk of that savings would simply go to premium reductions for the small businesses or large businesses or individuals that are buying insurance. If there is no savings, there will be no withhold. And you know, the numbers, sure, it's speculative, but we had very significant people. We had actuaries come in, and we had consultants from Washington that looked at our numbers, and they believe that we can get 20% savings. And if we were to take what it would cost to cover all the uninsured at the subsidies levels that we built into this bill, it would take, of that 20% savings, 18% would go to the payers of insurance, and 2% would go to subsidize more people getting health insurance.
Thank you, Representative Hunley. Anything more, Vanzelli?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's a saying about you can wish in one hand, and but I will let Representative Dita Forrest.
Unless there's any further comments, Representative Hunley, you want to say what you usually say at the end of your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, just one comment. The things we're looking at different from the payment system are being talked about nationally by certainly CMS and Medicare. Already, major corporations are changing their health plans to do the same kind of payment reform that we're doing. General Mills has said that they're going to do this in their self-insured product. Carlson Companies is going to do this because they believe the savings are there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative De La Forest, have you, Zellers, you woke the sleeping giant?
No, I remember how that phrase ends.
Representative De La Forest.
Representative Huntley, I do really wish you well as you move forward with this, because as I read it and I look at the recent history, especially in other jurisdictions that have attempted sort of government-imposed solutions, they haven't been successful, and I really do. I hope that some type of good resolution is reached that actually is to the benefit of the citizens of the state, because I'm really quite troubled, because as I read through the bill, I see it's filled with mandates and assessments and the like, and more than that, seems to be based still on an infrastructure of the employer, and the employer is frequently included, and it seems to me, at least to my way of thinking philosophically, we need to get away from the model of thinking of healthcare as sort of an employer-provided thing. Not that it's a bad thing, and not that employers can't provide healthcare. That's fine that they do. But we've heard talk about portability and ownership and how much better it can be when the individual gets to take advantage of their own healthcare, and it can be successful. So, frankly, as I see it philosophically, there's a disconnect here, and perhaps I'm missing it, between two different healthcare models. And I'm troubled by what appears to be this is sort of an old model in many respects that looks back in relying upon government mandates and employer mandates and the like to meet the goal that we all share, and that is good health care that can be universally applied at a reasonable cost that gives us all good quality. And so I will try, despite my limited expertise, to help out where I can, but I really wish all the participants luck. It's a complex issue. There's a lot of work that's involved, and I know that everyone's motives are pure. I really do. I really wish all of us luck in moving forward on this. This is one heck of an issue. So those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Representative De La Forest. A pretty good summation. It's been a thorough and thoughtful discussion of House File 3391. And Representative Huntley, we wish you continued success and hopefully on this work in progress, trying to find even greater peace in the valley with respect to it. With that, Representative Lilly will renew his motion that House File 3391 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. Is there a recommendation to the re-referral to Health and Human Services Finance?
Yes, to Finance.
That's to the Division on Health and Human Services Finance. For the discussion, seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. That motion carries. The bill passed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Representative Hillstrom stepping in as Representative Nelson. Welcome to the committee. The chair will move that House File 2918, Senate File 2918, also known as House File 3474, be recommended to pass and referred to the committee. Referred to the House floor. Representative Nelson, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome back to the committee again. I'm pitching tonight for Representative Hillstrom on Senate File 2918, and what this bill does, it's a little smaller bill, but this bill provides that if a defendant fails to appear in a hearing at a mortgager's request for a reduced redemption period, and the mortgager has made the request based upon a claim that the property is abandoned, that the defendant's failure to appear is conclusive evidence that the property has been abandoned, and for this provision to apply, the defendant must have received proper notice consistent with the requirements for service of the process in a civil action. And with that, I
thank you, Representative Nelson. Unless there's anyone here in opposition to the bill, seeing none, The chair will renew his motion that House file, Senate file, I can't stand Senate file, Senate file 2918 be recommended passed and referred to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Next up is House file 2351. Representative Johnson recommends or moves House file 2351 be recommended passed and off to the House floor. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2351, members, is a bill that directs a study to be conducted of the impact of legislation in at least three states that have enacted statewide video franchising. And just as a way of putting in context, under Minnesota Statute 238, companies that provide cable TV are franchised exclusively by municipalities. That's the current state law. During the interim, we had a good deal of time was spent on this issue, meeting with different stakeholders, talking about the issue of statewide franchising, where that made sense or not. And I had a variety of meetings with individual stakeholders. We also convened a working group that met on three occasions with the major players who were affected by the issues. And the issues that we talked about were treatment of local franchise fees, peg issues, and so forth, INET. In those discussions, references are made to dozens or so of other states that have adopted statewide franchising, and some participants argued that statewide franchising led to increased competition, more access, and lower prices, while other participants asserted the opposite. So the purpose of the study then is just to get some information, get some base information to know what we're talking about, and can move forward with some good public policy for the state of Minnesota. And that, in essence, Mr. Chair, is the bill before us.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. My understanding is there is an author's amendment, the A2 amendment. Is that yours?
But I'll accept it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Johnson. That is the 2351 A2 amendment has been incorporated by the author's acceptance. Is there further discussion of the bill or anyone that desires to testify, particularly testify in opposition of the bill? Seeing none, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 2351 be recommended passed as amended and referred to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Johnson moves House File 2959 be recommended passed, referred to the Committee on Finance for the recommended re-referral to the Committee on Energy Policy and Finance. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2959 is a bill that deals with broadband mapping. One of the first steps in providing broadband service to all Minnesotans, of course, is to map the current broadband service throughout the state. So then we want to get some base information on where broadband currently exists. And what House File 2959 does is fund a project that will produce a comprehensive statewide inventory and mapping of existing broadband service and capability. We'll get two different maps, both of which will be very helpful in clarifying in the state of Minnesota where broadband exists. And Mr. Chair, is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. It's my understanding there's two amendments, the A2 and the A3. Are you comfortable with those amendments?
Yeah, those are my amendments, and I wish to see them incorporated into the bill.
All in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. A3 amendment, all in favor, say aye. Representative Johnson moves that. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
It's kind of nice if we at least get to see them before we vote on them. I haven't got the two yet, and just handed you the three after you voted on both. I'm sure they're quite good, sir.
They're wonderful, Representative Simpson. We'll continue to work through, if you have any reservations about those, please just let us know before we take final action on the bill. Are there questions or concerns with respect to the bill? Representative Zeller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I'm curious as to the first paragraph there, line 1.7, starting at 1.6, the Commissioner of Commerce shall contract with a nonprofit organization to produce a comprehensive statewide inventory mapping of existing broadband services and capabilities. Any particular reason why it's a nonprofit versus for-profit versus government entity versus...
there's a specific nonprofit we have in mind, and the amendment, the A3 amendment, kind of clarifies in its description which organization we have in mind. It's called Connected Nation. They've been involved in this sort of mapping in at least four or five other states in the country and seem to have the trust of the major providers, the big cable companies, big telephone companies, the independent telephone companies and the like. And essentially what they provide that's so important is the ability to provide disclosure agreements so these companies be willing to provide the information which otherwise might be proprietary, which they'd be unwilling to do seemingly with like with the Commerce Department or state organizations.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson, so is there no one else, are there any other companies out there that we could contract or put out an RFP that the providers may, I understand the proprietary nature, but is there an uninterested third party that could also do this? I say that as no offense, but it just kind of concerns me when we're spending $175,000 to one organization in law. If we do it, Mindy, this is a question for Mr. Pender. If we've done it in the past, if we do it in, for others, that's fine, but I'm kind of concerned that there's not an RFP process in this.
The primary thing, I think, is that they have a proven track record and, have the okay approval of the major providers that'd be involved in the state to provide that information. We want to kind of move ahead, given that we have a major initiative with the broadband task force, and we want to get some information. This particular organization, which again has this track record, they can provide the maps needed within 4 to 6 months upon completion of the, once this bill moves forward in the past. So that's the thinking on it, in a nutshell.
Are there additional questions or concerns? Representative Anderson?
Just a couple. How certain are we that this data is going to be helpful to us when it may be obsolete to this collection?
Representative Johnson?
How long it would last? They do quarterly updates over the course of the year, that so it would be good at least clearly for the task force in as much as they'd be put together and ready to go within a year so they'd have it for their use.
Representative Anderson?
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the second question I had, I see that the appropriation is coming out of the telephone assistance fund. Have we typically used money out of that fund to do something like this?
Yes, that's been done before for not precisely this project, but when there has been excess amount of funds, that source of money has been used for projects.
Are there other questions or concerns or any other testimony with respect to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Johnson will renew his motion that House File 2959 be recommended for pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on Energy Policy and Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion carries. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Next up, Representative Lilly will move House File 3823 be recommended for pass and referred to the House floor. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, members and Mr. Chair and members. House File 3823 will ensure that the relationship that currently exists between Minnesota auto repair shops and the customers will remain intact. I don't know, we have a testifier here. I can kind of go do the long or short version, whatever you like.
I think you might know which one we prefer, Representative Lilly.
Evening. It's a very short bill, but that's sometimes not make it easy. I have Mr. Amberson here that could speak to it. If there's any questions, I'll stand for questions.
Okay. Do you have brief testimony, Mr. Anderson?
I do, and if you'd like, I can try and give a brief summary. My name is Darrell Amberson. I'm the president of Lehman's Garage. We've been in existence since 1917. I've been in the industry for over 30 years. In a nutshell, our concern with this issue is the conflict of interest by having an insurer own a repair shop. This was an issue that was dealt with in the state of Texas. Legislators typically defer action on bills when they're in the midst of a court challenge, so we delayed the action at this time. Ultimately, the Federal District Court and Federal Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the Texas law. This took a few years in the state of Texas. I'd like to just read a couple sentences that is a quote from the district court proceedings. But the court also found the trial record replete with proof that members of the Texas legislature were concerned with the lack of independence and conflicts of interest that arise when a consumer repairs his or her vehicle at an auto body shop owned by his or her insurance company. Witnesses testified to support these concerns, such as insurance companies cutting costs on repairs, approving only partial repairs, requiring that cars be repaired instead of totaled, trying to steer customers to insured-owned shops, and Allstate terminating pro shops in order to increase business for Sterling. Sterling was their own repair facility. So in a nutshell, what we are proposing is that we have legislation to prohibit this from occurring in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Is there anyone else who desires to testify? Mr. Franzen.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Doug Franzen. I'm representing the property casualty insurers of America and Allstate Insurance. I would have to begin by acknowledging I do have a conflict of interest here. I'm a very long-time customer of Lehman. And regardless, even if Allstate takes over every other body shop, I will continue to use Lehman's because I do want to testify they do exceptional work. So,
and you're a bad driver?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I have two teenage children. Mr. Chairman, we oppose this bill. I'll be very brief. There's not a problem that needs to be solved. There's no suggestion that Allstate, State Farm, anyone else is going to come into Minnesota and buy or create body shops. We think this type of market intrusion in light of nothing happening, just simply prohibiting any vertical integration just because, may be good for a lot of things, but certainly not necessarily good for the consumer. In fact, I could have, if the time permitting, I could make an argument that vertical integration would, in fact, benefit the consumer. The consumer will be deprived and the market will never be able to establish that. We believe it's just anti-competition, it's anti-consumer, and again, we have, I'm aware of no insurance company that wants to come into Minnesota and buy auto shops. It's the solution looking for a problem.
Thank you, Mr. Franzen. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Are there questions, comments from members of the committee? If not, Representative Lilly will renew his motion that House File 3823 be recommended to pass and refer to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Lilly. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Franzen. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Oh, we had this one. Oh, never mind. Okay, enough said. Thank you very much for coming to your committee. And you did an excellent job today.
You don't want to hear this show?
No.
Mr. Amendment coming.
What John told me like 3 hours ago. And my, I'm not the brightest fella. Representative Zellers, are you ready to present your bill? It would be House File 3650. Representative Zellers moves House File 3650. He recommended to pass and referred to the House floor. Is that correct?
I believe so, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Zellers, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill, again, if you sit at home and listen to your wife, sometimes you come up with good ideas, not on your own, but out of her urging, I brought the bill before you that basically addresses a problem that should have been solved. And, Mr. Chairman, I apologize. There is a brief amendment, author's amendment to the bill. Just to belt and suspenders some of the folks, Goodwill or a church group that may have a secondhand shop that has things brought in, dropped off for them. Again, they may not know where they come from because they come from a private home individual group. But just so that they're not knowingly accepting this information.
Fair enough.
Good.
That's your Representative Zellers. That's your A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Representative Zellers moves the A1 amendment to address that issue. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, the issue is we have toys that are being banned. Everybody's seen them around. I had folks from Children's Hospital that were willing to come down today. Once I saw the agenda, I wanted to make sure that they'll accept my children again when they get sick, so I didn't rather bring them down here to be tortured today. The gentleman from the Plastics Council was here. Again,
we wore him down, Representative.
I actually didn't even ask him for a nod as he went out the door after what he went through, so I said, thanks for coming. They were going to testify on behalf, especially the toy manufacturers. We're just trying to keep toys that have been recalled from getting back into circulation, whether they're lead-covered, plastic-covered, whatever it may be.
Representative Dillard, I was actually more interested to see who was going to come in opposition to the bill. You know, the bags of glass people that wanted
to... There was a glass-blowing club that was trying to set up time, but they just couldn't get all the...
Yeah, well, maybe it's on the House floor. We'll see them up in the gallery. But are there any questions, concerns with respect to this bill or anyone that desires to be heard? Seeing none, Representative Zellers renews his motion that House File 3650 be recommended, passed, and referred to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you, Representative Zellers. I left, I think, folks, the only two bills remaining on your agenda are my bills, 3545 and 3864. I'm hoping you will let me present those bills. Representative Lilly, if you want to...
I heard that.
Is that a second?
Should we recall that last bill?
Mr. Chair, which bill would you like to go ahead and move the bill you prefer first?
Thank you, Chair Lilly. House File 3545. I will move that bill be recommended, passed, and referred to the House floor. There is an author's amendment, Mr. Chair. You'll find it, members, in your materials, the A3 amendment. I would move the A3 amendment. I appreciate your support.
Oh, Mr.
Greenhouse
Gaffron?
Okay,
30. I could.
Or perhaps, members, you won't find it in your materials, and it'll be distributed to you magically as we discuss it. Why don't, Mr. Chair, having moved it, why don't I want to make sure that I'm cognizant of Representative Simpson's comments earlier, but actually having it in hand.
We have it.
All right. See, what it does is I did listen to some folks that had some concerns about how this would impact certain industries and have taken their, literally their proposals into account in order to make the bill acceptable and one that will work in the real world. I'll explain that further once we get the amendment on, and I'll go to the entirety of the bill.
Any questions to the amendment? Chair Atkins moves. You're moving the A2?
It's A3, Mr. Chair.
The A3 amendment. Everybody have a copy of that?
A3? Yes.
Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment is added. Are you moving also the A2, sir? Or is that?
If I have the A2, Mr. Chair. Perhaps that's in hand here. Actually, Mr. Chair, I believe the A3 accomplishes the A2. We had a little bit of additional work that the A3 dealt with, so I do not need to move the A2. And
so we have House File 3545.
-1
before us as amended. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the Reader's Digest version. There are high potency greenhouse gases such as sulfur hexafluoride that are literally 23,000 times as in terms of their impact as a pound of carbon. We have done a splendid job in Minnesota of trying to take on the greenhouse gas issue. What this one does is get after some gases that have not been identified previously but are much more potent and have much more of an impact with respect to the greenhouse gas issue. We have done it in as business-friendly of a fashion as we can, and in addition to that, I have put on the A3 amendment to further address business concerns, but it's still a highly effective bill that gets after some of those greenhouse gases that are not carbon, but are far more harmful. And with that, I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Sorry. First time I've met you, sir. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, I'm looking on page 4 of the bill. It's the section that's talking about motor vehicle sales. And that limiting what kind of vehicles can be sold at a certain point. Can you tell me what vehicles would fall under this category? That are currently made?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this the way that we phrased it, it's basically those vehicles that are out there being sold at a minimum of 1,000 units. So it's going to be something that is already in place, that they're already accustomed to. I've not gotten any pushback from them. I think they've looked at the language and have not opposed it.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative, you don't have any examples of what vehicles this would be?
Representative, or Chair Lilly, Representative Anderson, my
question on cars.
Looks like we have a...
I was going to say, I will phone a friend at this point, because I think we can address that much more rapidly than if I try to.
Please state your name
right
for the record.
Yes.
Go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Kevin Reuther, R-E-U-T-H-E-R, from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I think, actually, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative, that you may be looking at a section of the bill that is removed with the A3 amendment.
Okay.
It was the section entitled Motor Vehicle Sales that you were looking at, is that right?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I am looking at, I'm looking at the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment deletes page 3, section 5. And I'm looking at section 6. Am I missing an amendment here?
We are.
Okay.
Chair and members, unfortunately, it appears that what you have in your packets, we were working off the DE1 version. The section 5 that the amendment addressed actually took out the renumbered sections that you're referencing now.
Okay.
And just so we're absolutely clear on the record, Mr. Chair, that the DE1, which is the most recent engrossment of the bill, section 6 in the document that you have apparently in your folders refers to motor vehicle sales. When in the DE1, that was renumbered as section 5. You will see in the A3 amendment that we have deleted section 5. And that did alleviate the concern of that industry. I apologize for that lack of clarity, members.
Representative Anderson, any further questions? Good job with your cold and everything, and this time of night, and attention to detail. Very most impressive.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Chair Atkins, seems how this deal with air conditioning that, you know, pipe fitters worry about. Have you talked to the pipe trades at all?
Chair Atkins or Mr. Ruther?
This chair and members got the DE1. I came up here without the DE1 and I apologize.
Mr. Chair?
There's a copy coming out.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll pass on that particular question.
It's an excellent question because I think we addressed it in the DE1. Thank you. The short answer is no. The longer answer is that we've made sure that the bill has been out for public comment for at least a few weeks now and have not heard any opposition to it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney, any follow-up?
I'm fine with this bill.
Representative Simpson?
Mr. Chair, I also have to, you know, anytime I see the word refrigerant, as my fine friend across the road there, our table says, I have to kind of perk my ears too, as the in the grocery business we use lots of refrigerants. So when I first saw this, it caught my eye, but I can see we're good to go. Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Simpson, it's primarily a disclosure issue.
Chair Atkins, are you aware of anybody else that'd like to be heard on this?
I am not, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Chair Atkins renews his motion that House File 3545 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the House floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Your bill passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On to your next one, sir.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 3864, I would move that that be passed and sent to the House floor.
Chair Atkins has moved that I lost it here on the sheet. House 3064, be recommended to pass and sent to the House floor. Go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Very briefly, this provides for licensing of auto repair shops. It's been a work in progress. Mr. Wally is, in fact, my friend from Lehman, where we all go to get our cars fixed. Can discuss it in further detail. We've tried to figure out the costs associated with doing this, and that's been something that we've tried to get our arms around. But with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Anderson. He can talk to you about the needs, why this makes sense.
Go ahead, sir.
I'm Darrell Anderson with Lehman's Garage, also representing the Alliance of Automotive Service Providers of Minnesota. Ultimately, the collision repair shops, the state felt the time has come to establish minimum standards to ensure that all repair shops are in compliance with current state and federal laws and regulations, and that they had a commitment to continuing education and the necessary equipment to effect safe and thorough repairs to damaged vehicles. Today's vehicles are designed and tested to provide a high level of passenger protection in the event of a collision, including the use of specified crash zones. As a repair industry, it is imperative that we precisely duplicate the factory's construction methods so that the vehicle reacts exactly the same after we perform a repair. That includes duplicating the number and quality of spot welds, using only factory-specified heat levels on structural components, and using only factory-specified sectioning methods on structural components that don't cause the components to be stronger or weaker. We are dealing with new material technologies, including several varieties of aluminum, magnesium, boron steel, and other high-carbon, ultra high-strength steel. At Lehman's, we utilize MIG welders, resistant spot welders, sophisticated measuring and pulling equipment, computerized alignment equipment, and high-tech diagnostic equipment. We obtain factory repair procedures through conventional educational sources, industry-specific sources such as ICAR, internet-based factory information warehouse sources, factory websites, and other sources. 43,000 people die in vehicle collisions on our nation's roads annually. We cannot overemphasize the importance of safe vehicles, one that react in a collision as they were designed. Substandard repairs pose a safety risk for drivers, passengers, and all who share the road. The education and equipment requirements we propose are similar to the minimum requirements in some direct insurance direct repair program requirements. In Minnesota, hairdressers and barbers are licensed. Doesn't it make sense that we take steps to assure the competence of those repairing the vehicles on our highways? I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. The Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Anderson?
Amberson.
Mm-hmm. I knew I got it. You got Lily disease. The question is more to, you know, just looking at some of the licensure penalties and some of the application process. I agree with you, we want uniform standards. Mm-hmm. My concern is for, and I apologize, I haven't had to have my car taken to your shop yet, but I'm more concerned about the small mom and pop shops being not necessarily pushed out, but having such an onerous burden on them when it comes to these rules and regulations that they may just decide, you know what, I'll sell out to one of the big shops, or they'll be pushed out of business because they don't have a fleet of lawyers to help them navigate. I'm assuming you're a smaller shop. Personally, what's your assessment of what some of these are going to do to members?
We feel like the equipment and education requirements are very reasonable. Like I said, many insurance companies are requiring this of direct repair relationships already. We also feel that we have concern over the issues that you expressed, but on one hand, you're balancing safety of your family and yourself and the other cars on the highway versus someone's economic impact. And we feel safety should weigh out. It is an unfortunate reality that some may be negatively affected by this, but the fact of the matter is, the way the industry is gone right now with technology, we feel appropriate that either you step up or get out. I mean, you got to do the job appropriately. Safety should be the supreme issue here.
Representative Zeller.
Thank you. And Mr. Anderson, just one follow-up then. As far as an association is concerned, for those folks, maybe the smaller, either through cooperative sharing of software or techniques or training, there's something that the association is offering for some of those smaller shops that want to still stay in the business but don't want to get to an advertise or sell out to somebody like that.
Yes, there are some provisions in here where certain aspects of the repair could be sublet to an entity that could be in compliance with it so that they wouldn't have to assume the responsibility of the equipment purchases or the education levels.
Thank you, Jim.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having done a number of licensing bills over the last year or so, this is a pretty thorough bill. You've done your job. My question is on page 3, line 25. Actually, it starts a little above that and goes beyond that. You're actually setting standards for safety in the shop. Now, doesn't OSHA cover that, or are you meeting OSHA standards and you just didn't put them in other than in line 21 to 24, and all the rest of them are just assumed to be OSHA standards? Or
you are correct. We are duplicating some OSHA standards and some other standards as well that are minimum safety requirements for shops. There's also new EPA regulations coming out that we've taken into consideration here that would cause us to be in compliance. By the new EPA regulations, we'll be required to have specified paint structures, essentially paint booths and some other equipment to operate.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Amberson, I actually read that somewhere in here. You might want to just, to the author, you might want to put in some reference to OSHA beyond that particular part.
Thank you. Chair Atkins, Representative Simpson. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, this is the first I've heard of this. Is this a consumer driven or is this business driven? Who's after this?
Chair Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simpson, it's actually both. From the consumer standpoint, you've got these very complex pieces of equipment out there now, and we want them to be safe. From the business side of things, obviously the entire industry suffers a black eye if vehicles aren't repaired appropriately. And so it's actually being driven, pardon the pun, but from both sides of the perspective. One thing, if I might, because I did misspeak earlier, I think I suggested to the House floor, this does need to go to public safety and civil justice, and it to give us an opportunity to address some of the, for example, Representative Mahoney's OSHA reference that we'd want to make sure we take care of as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have some concerns from the standpoint of our small communities that I represent. I have 17 towns out there, and in those 17 towns, I think probably every one of them has a small body shop of some sort. And we had the opportunity here last year to pass some legislation that affects plumbers in our small communities, and we're seeing some side effects of that. And so I just would like to make sure that we're being a little careful on how aggressive we're getting on these, on some of these legislations. So.
And actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Simpson, my sense of this bill at this point, in light of some of the issues we've encountered, is that its likelihood of being able to move through both bodies this year is not, it's nowhere near 100%, put it that way. So I think we are going to have an opportunity to make sure that we are fully apprised of what the impact is. Mm-hmm. And the more impact the more input that we can get, we'd welcome. So if your 17 local body folks want to get in touch with us, we'd appreciate that too.
Right. Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Chairman, can I address that also?
Yes, sir, go ahead.
One side benefit of this is the fact that for those of us who do invest the time, effort, and expense to be in compliance with these things, which I think most legitimate body shops in our state would, many in small towns, a benefit of this is that sometimes we're grouped together with those that don't comply with all these things, and the insurers look at us all in one group, and sometimes those that don't have this equipment and education are the ones driving some lower labor rates. And so the small business operator can be benefited by having this being segregated to some extent, that being a more legitimate collision repair facility by meeting this compliance, and therefore differentiating ourselves from those that have drive some of the lower labor rates that we experience.
Chair Atkins, are you aware of anybody else that would like to be heard in the audience?
I don't think so, Mr. Chair. I assume they would have rushed down by now. So
okay. Any further questions up here?
I'll renew my motion that House File 3864 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? You're on your way, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
With that, we're adjourned.